State Senator Daniel Fisk, author and Slate contributor Justin Peters, and the return of Steve Gadlin and the Frying Pan. And now, here's your host, a man who considers himself to be the Cam Newton of AM radio, Justin Kaufman.
Because of my charity work. And you know Cam Newton, everyone loves Cam Newton. Everybody loves Cam Newton. All right, I love Cam Newton. Maybe I'm the only one. What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. I love Cam Newton. I was looking at some stuff, and I know Mark Carmen was talking about it. Just it's the idea that, you know, he's not a very liked quarterback, which I find to be kind of ridiculous. I really like Cam Newton. I think he's, you know, I was thinking about it because I saw some people post some stuff about, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, but just about the race card that's involved, like that maybe white people don't like Cam Newton. But there's, on the reverse side, I'm always like, yeah, but that's football, right? I mean, I don't necessarily like Peyton Manning, you know, and I have friends, I hate Tom Brady. Like, there's a lot of love and hate, Jay Cutler. You know what I mean? So for someone to say, I hate Cam Newton, and then automatically, oh, you're racist. That's crazy, right? You're allowed to hate in football. Welcome to The Download. It's Friday night in the greater Chicago area. Congratulations for making it through another week. If you're listening at home or at work or in the car, as you pretend like it's summer and head to the lake house, we got you covered tonight. Got a nice wrap-up conversation on the political week that was with State Senator Daniel Biss. Biss was one of my first guests on this show where he suggested that a budget deal would get done. That was back in April, so we bring him back tonight to talk about all the flashing lights in Springfield this week. My guest tonight at the big table is Slate contributor and author Justin Peters. Peters wrote the book The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. It's a detailed look at the short life of activist Aaron Swartz, who took his own life while under prosecution from the federal government. We'll talk about what both sides were fighting for when it comes to the future of the Internet. It's a very interesting book, and I'm really happy to talk to Justin Peters. And from the Internet and the newspaper, New City, the popular Alt Weekly is celebrating its 30th anniversary. Brian Hagelke will be in studio later to talk about the anniversary. I'm excited to talk to Brian. Love that play. I love that paper. They do the best of. New City's best of. It's just sort of a mainstay here in Chicago. I really like it. I have a great story about I once, through Schadenfreude, got to be on the front cover, right? I'll tell the story a little bit later about Lonnie Anderson and the legal department at New City. We'll talk about it. And tonight's the return of the frying pan. Woo! That's right. Local entrepreneur Steve Gadlin brings us his latest idea and inventions, and we, the Download Nation, give him a thumbs up or a thumbs down. That's coming up after 10 o'clock tonight. I'm excited to have him back. We've been off so many Fridays in a row because of the Blackhawks. We haven't been able to get Steve in here, but he's back, and we've got a little consistent run coming. So he told me today that he's got some great ideas, and tonight's foolproof. He doesn't tell us the ideas in advance. I hear him the same time you do. And he says, tonight, surefire winner. So all that plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, let's get to the carryout. Of course, this is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The ratings are out. The GOP debate last night outperformed Donald Trump, who spoke at a veterans fundraiser, which was carried by CNN. We'll see what happens tomorrow when CNN broadcasts an iPhone recording of the O'Reilly Factor. And Fox just goes ahead and puts a camera in Trump's bathroom with the scroll, breaking news, Trump about to blow dry. And also, we always say that politics is sport. So if that's true, when Donald Trump tweets out that moderator Megyn Kelly is a bimbo, or says he could shoot somebody and none of his followers would care, could we just suspend him for a couple days? I mean, maybe he's got to sit out New Hampshire. I mean, Jonathan Taves is sick and the NHL suspended him for a whole game. I'd say a presidential candidate tweeting that a debate moderator is a bimbo is at least worth that. Maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 10? The whole year, please?
Hillary Clinton's in hot water because the feds say that she had 22 emails that were top secret on her server. Good, we caught her how to turn on Benghazi. No, that's not what this is about anymore. Hey, all right, though. How dare she send emails with top secret stuff to other officials that were supposed to see that stuff? Wait, what are we mad about again? Oh, that's right. It's Hillary. President Obama will come speak at the Rotunda in Springfield sometime next month. Why? Well, I think he may have left his umbrella. Or maybe some old pens and some paper clips. Or you never know, he's looking for a job. Sources say Governor Rauner would like to have a beer with him when he comes. But have you seen the bars in Springfield? I'm not sure the president likes natty ice. Today, Governor Rauner declined to expand the ailments list for medical marijuana clearance. There's mounting pressure to include more ailments, both for the patients and the businesses. When reached for comment, pot smokers said, you know, it's really easy to get marijuana, right? You necessarily have to get it through medical marijuana. CPS is giving kids who cheat to get into selective enrollment schools a lifetime ban if caught. So word of warning, if caught, well, there'll be no one left to go to selective enrollment schools because let's face it, everybody cheats. The old Navy Pier Ferris wheel is going to be preserved in Branson, Missouri, because nothing says old and high like Branson, Missouri. This weekend is the competitive one at the box office. The movies that are opening, The Finest Hours, it's a boat rescue movie, 50 Shades of Black, a Wayans parody, and Kung Fu Panda 3, because the story didn't wrap up in 2. I wonder who wins. My guess, Star Wars. In weather, today's the first day of 2016, where the sun set after 5 o'clock, 5:01 p.m. to be exact. That plus the 50-degree weather this weekend, I'm getting out the old slip and slide. In sports, the Bulls beat the Lakers last night in Tinseltown. Kobe played and played the worst game of his career against the Bulls. Also, Jimmy Butler's new boyfriend Mark Wahlberg was there because, you know, Jimmy Buckets is the new Johnny Drama. The NHL All-Star Game is tomorrow night. Boring. I'm telling you, Blackhawks versus everybody else. Then I'd watch. And of course, it has to be in Nashville. Why does hockey have to always be in Nashville? Feels like every time the Hawks play anybody, it's the Nashville Predators. And now the All-Star Game is in Nashville? Enough of Nashville! The Chargers look to be staying in San Diego after rumors had them moving the NFL franchise to Los Angeles. When reached for comment, San Diego residents said, wait, does this mean Philip Rivers stays too? And then they went surfing and ate fish tacos and enjoyed the freeway system. That's really all I know about San Diego. That's really the limit. In baseball, it's a Sox Fest down at Hilton Towers. I'd go to Sox Fest if Dotson, Hoyt, Bannister, both laws, Julio Cruz, Luzinski, Kittle, Fisk, and Chet Lemon were hanging out at Kitty O'Shea's. Otherwise, what's the point? Northwestern lost to Michigan State by 30 last night, dropping them to 3-6 in the Big Ten. They get Iowa this weekend. Yikes. Maybe they can hope for that Iowa snowstorm to come early. At this rate, the Cats got to win some big games just to be considered a bubble team. But hey, if you're a Cats fan, you could take solace in the fact that Illinois sucks too. And finally, today a court ruled that panhandlers couldn't be excluded from Daily Plaza and that the panhandlers in question would both receive $1,500 in damages, which the panhandlers replied, cool. Can I get it in coins? That's the carryout for January 29, 2016. Happy birthday, Mom.
Coming up, some tips for winter driving in Chicago as that storm that's threatening the Iowa caucuses will be here later in the week. Also, a sit-down interview with Justin Peter, the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz, and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. That's all tonight on The Download here on WGN. Stay with us. Download here on WGN Radio. Lots to do tonight. State Senator Daniel Biss will drop by in studio. I'm excited to talk to him because it feels after this week that most of Springfield and the work that needs to get done is being done by a really small percentage of people that were represented, the Democratic leaders, Republican leaders, and everybody else is just sitting on their hands. You don't hear too much. I mean, we saw a little bit with the MAP grant stuff yesterday, and it's still we'll see if the governor actually vetoes that bill. But they want to do something. They want to try to do something. They want to shake it up. But there is no budget, you know, and they're not really being asked to be part of the process. So I'll ask Senator Biss about that and see what he says. Like I said, he was one of the first guests on this show, politician, Democratic senator from Skokie and Glenview. So he's back at the week that was in Springfield. We'll talk to him tonight on the download. Also tonight, I'm excited to talk to Justin Peters. Justin is a correspondent for Slate and also a contributor for the Columbia Journalism Review. And, you know, he wrote the book, The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. Aaron Swartz is the kid who took his own life after he was under indictment being prosecuted by the federal government, the Justice Department, for Internet crimes. Essentially what he did was he went and he broke into MIT and he downloaded all the academic journals and things that are that cost money. I didn't know anything about this. I mean, to be honest, I don't know a lot about this area, and Justin will explain, but the idea that the academic publishing world is really a lucrative world. There's copyright, and essentially if you want to get at some of the research that's been done at a different university, you have to go through these organizations that charge $50,000 a year to the university, and the university gets them, not necessarily the students and so on and so forth. So he took it in his own hands as an activist, as a computer hacker, to go in and download those things. Now, he never actually distributed them or did any sort of Robin Hood stuff. He was caught before that happened, and then there became this long, drawn-out sort of argument about whether or not he was going to do that. And he says, no, I wasn't. The Justice Department said, yes, you were. And the Justice Department was going to throw the book at him. They were looking at, I mean, something like 50 years in prison. And they just kept going and kept going. And there was some argument at the time, if you remember the story, this was just, you know, 2-3 years ago. There was some argument at the time that this was really because they couldn't get at Edward Snowden, or they couldn't get at the guy Assange from WikiLeaks, because those guys were in hiding. So they had like the third guy. And so they said, we need to teach everybody who works in computer crimes a lesson. And the lesson will be Aaron Swartz. And he took his own life. And there's been that culture, the free internet culture, and we'll talk about this coming up at 8 o'clock, mourns Aaron and continues to fight the fight that he wanted to make open ideas and information free on the internet. So we'll talk to Justin Peters about that coming up here on The Download. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know what? Even though it's going to be nice this weekend, the same storm that is coming through that's going to wreak havoc with the Iowa caucuses is coming to Chicago next week, and that means winter weather returns. We're here today with Char Schoenbach. She's a 26-year Allstate agent with the office on North Halsted Street in Lakeview in Boys Town. She's going to talk to us this evening about ways to keep you and your car safe this winter. And should you get into an accident, Char will share important next steps. Char Schoenbach, thanks for being here.
Thank you for
having me.
Good
to see you. All right, so let's talk about this. I mean, because we've had some winter storms under our belt, and there's another one coming here.
Yes.
And, of course, that means resulting accidents on the roadways. What does Allstate offer that creates peace of mind for drivers?
Well, Allstate Insurance Company, you know, we care about people. We care about people on the road everywhere. And we have the Allstate mobile app. It's very simple to download and use, and it has a lot of good information, including roadside assistance, mm-hmm. to offer people a checklist so they have something to refer to at this time, God forbid, of their accident.
Yeah, that's great. Can I just say that's great? As a driver, I'm always confused about what to do, and I'm always it creates a lot of anxiety for me that I'm like, well, I don't have the person's number on me. I'm about to go out and drive in this weather. Blah, blah, blah. So it's good to have that there's
maybe
an app.
Maybe you forgot your gloves. And
yeah,
it's cold.
Right. You guys will bring a shovel and a blanket.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, what can listeners be doing to help ensure they're maneuvering the roadways safely this winter?
First thing is people should prepare themselves for any dangerous situations. You're going to want to make sure, you know, have your headlights checked, make sure your brake lights work fully, and windshield wipers. Of course, make mm-hmm. sure you have some gloves in the car in case you have to get out, shovel and so on and so forth. Be careful of other people on the road at that point.
We hear this all the time. I mean, when there is severe weather, we always hear warnings from newscasters and weather people say, stay off the roads, stay, it's going to be bad, stay off the roads. But the truth is there's a lot of people who have to drive. I mean, you got to get to work, you got to do things. So what should drivers do if they have to drive in storms, winter storms?
Well, first of all, they want to be cognizant of what the weather is like. Take extra care if there's ice or snow, so on and so forth. You want to always travel at a little bit of a slower speed. You know, put in some extra time in your schedule to make sure that you're slow enough to avoid a collision, of course. Naturally, you want to keep your eyes on the road. You don't want to be texting and things of that nature.
The worst time to do that.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
You shouldn't text at all when you drive, but yeah, if there's a winter storm,
exactly.
Maybe that's the time.
Please don't text at this time. Exactly. And you know, it could be dangerous if you've had a couple glasses of wine or a few beers.
Yeah,
so
right.
That would probably be a good thing to follow. And you want to be really focused on the road, especially when it's slick and could be dangerous.
Yeah.
Just want to stay really focused on your surroundings.
So even if it is a passing zone, maybe during a winter storm, no need.
Just drive a little bit slower. One of the most important things is you want to try to stay calm during a skid. And we've all had that happen,
yeah.
I'm sure. I know I have. So if your car begins to slide or skid, again, try not to panic. Look down the road in the direction you want to go and then gently steer in that direction. You don't want to slam on the brakes as that will upset the car's balance and make it harder to gain control. So instead, just release the accelerator until the traction returns.
So easier said than done.
Of course, you know, of course.
Because I feel like in my situation, I'm like, I'm going to press this brake as hard as I can. But that's good. Don't do that. All right, so accidents do happen.
Right.
And unfortunately, at this time of year, it happens more than not because of the winter weather. So let's say you just got into an accident. Now what?
This is where the Allstate mobile app will come in handy. It provides you with an accident checklist, step-by-step directions on what to do. And, of course, realizing that you're upset, you need to take a minute, you've pulled over. After this, perhaps, let's say, collision, you want to call 911 for emergency. And it's right on the mobile
app.
Right. So you press it, and you're connected with somebody, probably the police station of the area of where you're located.
Okay. So 911, obviously. We get the police involved right away.
Right.
We don't do the downloads recommendation is to just, is there damage or no damage? Okay, everyone move on. You don't do that.
No. And then, of course, you want to check for injuries.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
Yourself, you're going to know right away, people in your car. And at this moment, you may be getting out of the car to talk to the other person.
Okay.
So that's first. You want to make sure that you've pulled over in a safe spot and wait for help.
Especially if you're not on you know, the expressways where they have that safe spot regulated. You really do have to think about where you're at because you don't want to be in a situation where you choose to deal with the accident puts you
right,
in harm's way.
Exactly. So if you're on the expressway and your car is drivable, just make sure you pull over to a safe area of the road, put your hazard lights on, turn off your engine. Otherwise, try to get your car and yourself mm-hmm. to a safe spot. Some other valuable information would be you want to share insurance information
mm-hmm.
with the person that you've had this collision
with. Beyond just a police report. I mean, you need to get that stuff because
absolutely.
The police aren't going to necessarily help you with that stuff. You want to get that from.
Absolutely.
Right.
So the first thing you may want to do if it's visible is write down the kind of car it is, the license plate.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you'll be able to get out of the car, exchange information, name, address, phone number. Naturally, you're going to perhaps wait for the police report. But if you have the Allstate mobile app, then you can pull up your ID card right away because you might be nervous. You may not want to be looking through your glove box or your purse that has a lot of things in it. You can pull the Allstate mobile app up. And there again, that's where you can call the police. That's where you can have your policy number and everything you need handy.
And this is always a good thing, too. I mean, for as much as you want to avoid using your phone for texting and all that kind of stuff when you're driving, after an accident, that's when you want to get the phone out and take some photos.
Absolutely. Which brings me to my next point. After you've exchanged some information, you've got your phone, you've saved your battery because you're not texting, you should use your phone to take some pictures.
Mm-hmm. And also one of the great things is that you can upload photos. You could take photos with your phone through this app, and it's all part of the process.
Absolutely. You snap your pictures, picture of the other car, of your car, perhaps their license plate and your license plate. You can upload those right through the app. It's amazing feature. So you have everything at your fingertips. This is a good way to help the process get started. And you'll already be a few steps ahead before the police get there.
For more information on winter safety tips and the Allstate mobile app, visit www.allstate.com. The app can be downloaded for the iPhone via iTunes and the App Store. Android users can get the app from Google Play. And if you want to contact Shar Schoenbach, how do we do that?
You can reach my office at 773-525-3030 or stop in the office at 3322 North Halsted Street.
Shar Schoenbach is a 26-year vet of the Allstate Agency, and she's an agent up on North Halsted Street, as you just said, in the Lakeview and Boys Town neighborhood. Shar, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Download here on WGN.
I'm excited. I should tell, it's interesting because that was a good segment about winter driving. The last time it was, I guess it was snowy out. It was probably in January, early January, mm-hmm. right? It was like one of those. So I got out of here and I drove home and I was going over the expressway on Randolph. And it kind of was like a little hill there. And I was coming down and boom. Just as Shar talked about, I started to skid. So I pumped the brakes. Nothing happens. And I can't do what you said. I can't steer it to a certain point because there's traffic in front of me. Like, it's only a matter of moments before I rear-end the person who's at the red light at the stop. So I go, man, I don't have a lot of options here. They had the high curbs.
Yeah.
And ran off. So it's not like you can just like, So I'm like, I'm going to have to like force the car into the curb because I'd rather deal with that and, you know, a body shop.
Yeah.
Than having to deal with the police and rear ending
injuring somebody.
And maybe
perhaps.
Injuring
yeah.
someone. Right.
Scary.
So I go for it. I go into the curb and I hear pop, you know, like just like pop, like it's just a smash.
Oh, no, you're thinking like,
man. I'm like, it's drivable. So I drive home. I get home. I park. You know, I go, you know, eyes kind of shut, and I look at the front, nothing. No damage. And I'm like, okay. So then I'm like, and I drove it, and I'm like, no rattle. Nothing.
God.
Like, complete bad karma.
Is it all a dream?
That's what I'm like, I don't think it really happened. And I was like, it looks like what happened is I just got lucky, and the curb hit the hubcap. You know, like, or the tire in the hubcap there. And because it hit that and not the body, there was no damage. It's just kind of like you can see a little bit of scuff on the hubcap. Now, I probably, you know, if I take it to the mechanic, alignment's off. That's expensive. I mean, that's fixable. You know that's what's going to happen. Like, I know for a fact.
Yeah.
I'm going to, next time I go get an oil change, they're going to be like, that's $3,500.
And when you're driving it now, you don't,
nothing.
There's no.
No, like, feel like, I thought maybe I'd hear a rattle or if I turn left or right, there'd be like a pop or something. Nothing.
That is amazing. That's
it's totally
lucky.
Amazing. I'm very lucky too because I kind of have an older car, so I mean that also like I feel like if it does break, like I was totally in the mindset of if I smash this up, I'm not fixing it. You know, I have a weird mindset. Like my dad, if he smashes something up, he's in the body shop like an hour later and it's fixed
fixing
and
everything is
it's fixed. Me with this car, I'm kind of like.
You're kind of a menace on the,
roads. I'm just sort of more like, I live in the city. I've had a car that had to park on the street, and it was an old Honda Civic. And so, like, the back bumper was just because, like, you couldn't even touch it with a finger without scratching the back bumper.
Yeah.
And so I think that just set the course of action as a car owner in the city of Chicago. And I'm like,
Yeah.
I'm not going to fix this for $600. I'm not going to, you know. I mean, if it's a window or if it's something that's really... you need to deal with as a car, you fix it. But like, just like vanity or you know, I don't care.
Yeah. I mean, you live in the city, you kind of expect to get dings from, you know, bumpers and stuff. That's why I always laugh at those, you know, people that drive, you know, the Civics and then they have the, you know, huge bumper, you know, thing that on there to protect from, you know, little dents or whatever. I'm
I was convinced that it was like a bad paint job. Because, you essentially when you park on the street, just people always tap the back. And every time it tapped, it would just be a scratch. So, like, I had the car for maybe 2 months. I had, like, 35 scratches on it. And like it was already looking like it was like the old, like I might as well have had the coexist bumper sticker on there. You know, like it just kind of looked that way. Living out of my car. And I'm like, I just bought this car. Like I took it back to Honda. And I was like, no, this doesn't work. And they're like, what? And I'm like, it shouldn't take like less than a month.
Yeah.
And I should have this many scratches. And I got them to paint it again for cheap or nothing. Because I argue so much. So, anyway, that's my story about cars. That's the extent of my stories about cars.
We can revisit this when we do our auto show broadcast.
That's right.
That we're doing in a couple of weeks.
That's right. We're going to be
maybe
live at the
tips.
Auto show. How about that? Which I thought would be really, really fun to have Bruce Wolf be a guest. But I don't think that's a good idea for the station.
Hope he's allowed in.
I don't think he's allowed. You have to wear like kind of a disguise. Chit-chat. We're going to be live at the auto show in February. That's great. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Right? That's like the epicenter.
We get to drive all the concept cars.
Yeah, and we need to do it like it's like when Conan goes to a different city. You know, we need to do a bunch of those kind of pieces where I go around with a microphone and just make fun of stuff. It'll be fun.
Yeah, a couple of weeks, I think, right?
Yeah, like I'm excited about it, right?
Yeah.
That'll be fun. I want to drive a Corvette. But that's not the... a proper hot car.
I think so.
I want to drive a hot car.
Yeah, but I mean, I think...
You don't drive it. You can't drive them. You can sit in them.
Yeah.
But be like, can I take it down 18th Street?
I don't think they allow that, no.
Can I go roll past the Randolph Row and let everyone see my Tesla?
Do they have cars of the future? Like,
I don't know. I've never been to a car show.
Cars that might be able to fly eventually.
I've known a lot of friends who do things at the car show. Like either they model or they act or they do like, ladies and gentlemen, look at this car. Like they get jobs like that. I've been to the boat show.
The boat show.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I've been to the boat show. Which I'm assuming is very similar to the car show.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll just pretend like it's a boat show. It's the same thing. Just don't stay in that Hyatt over there. Right? Did you see that last weekend? There are two different instances where there was a shooting in the lobby and then someone hung themselves up in the room like the next night. It's bad publicity for something that never is in the news. You ever that hotel, like that chain there, that is never in the news. That is like, that's just a bad coincidence for them. I mean, I've actually been in that hotel. It's a nice hotel. It's great. It's a business hotel. It's for the trade shows and for the tourism and stuff. But yeah, just bad luck that you got two bad news stories in one weekend. Yeah. It was last weekend, yeah. Anyway, coming up tonight, Senator Biss is going to be also Brian Hegelke, who's the publisher of New City. New City turns 30. They put out a edition this week that's 2046. They got a lot of Chicagoans, great people from Rebecca Mackay. Who else? I had this on the anyway. There's a lot of different people who are in there who write up Nick Kokonis. From Alinea. They write up what they think Chicago is going to be like in 2046, 30 years from now.
Awesome.
That's a great way to like sort of celebrate 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I love New City. And New City got a great story where with Schadenfreude, I made the we got on the cover for one. You know, it's
that's
like
huge.
I know it was for we were doing a new radio show, and it was a big article they did, and it was like, can they make the radio laugh? Right, and it was and so we came up with the concept like, well, we should do WKRP. We should all dress like the characters from WKRP. But we were one short. Like I got to play Hessman, but we were one short. No, we had no Lonnie Anderson. And I'm like, well, this cover would be awesome if you could superimpose the real Lonnie Anderson from the, like, we took the cover shot of WKRP, like the cover shot, where they're all like sitting. I got I like had my hand on my face. Yeah. I'm so bored.
Yeah.
I'm Hessman with the.
Yeah,
with,
I know. Well.
We did everything to a T, right? But we didn't have Lonnie Anderson, so we wanted to superimpose the real Lonnie Anderson from 1978 or whatever it was on my lap or whoever's lap it was. Mm-hmm. And New City's like, yeah, that'd be great. That'd be fun, you know? And then they came back and they're like, no. There's no way. Like they I think they reached out
to Lonnie Anderson.
They're like, no way. That's you can't take my likeness and do that. So like we went to print without it. So it still works because it just looks like we're being goofy improvisers who have funny costumes on. And it kind of looks KRP, But, man, we missed a golden op. I think that that would have been the coolest cover in New City history. The superimposed hologram Lonnie Anderson on my lap. And
yeah.
They couldn't do it. Like they reached out, and Lonnie Anderson's people were like, absolutely not. And if you bring our name up again, we'll sue everybody in Chicago.
Oh, my Lord.
Like, it's like one of those where you're like, well, okay, well, yeah, where's the loophole? There's no loophole. They shut it.
Yeah. You don't want to be involved with the wrath of Lonnie Anderson.
No. And, you know, she's,
the hammer down.
Yeah. Which she's, if she has anything left, it's lawyers. Right? That's what you would say. So, yeah, so we weren't able to do it. But it was a great article. And I remember that we went around to it used to be, you know, this is pre-internet age. I guess it would be 2002, 2003. So it was early. But, we went around to the actual kiosks or the newspaper machines and, like, waited for one night at, 3 in the morning for the trucks to drop it off so we could get a ton of them. Because there you are. You're on the front page of an alt-weekly.
That's amazing.
Cool. Yeah,
right.
We had Best Comedy a couple times in New City. New City has been great to me in my career. But this was a preview of the Schadenfreude radio show that we were doing on NPR.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Oh, yeah.
These guys gonna, and it was interesting. Like they came, they had a reporter come and sit in with our writing for 2 or 3 days. Pretty interesting. Anyway, so we'll talk to Brian coming up here on the download tonight. Welcome back to the download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's hard to believe that it's been 3 years to this month since cyber activist, computer programmer, and local prodigy Aaron Swartz took his own life in a Brooklyn studio. He was 26 years old. You remember this story. He illegally downloaded some academic research from MIT, and the federal government went after him hard. They indicted him on 13 felony counts of essentially computer crime. Swartz was facing up to 50 years in prison for downloading copyrighted academic materials. Yikes. Now a new book is out exploring the life and the case against Aaron. It's called The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. It's written by Justin Peters, who's a correspondent for Slate and a contributing editor at the Columbia Journalism Review, and he's my guest tonight. Justin, good to see you.
Hey, it's good to be here.
This is actually stems from an article you wrote not long after for Slate.
Yeah, so literally 4 days after Aaron died, my editor said, we want you to do this story, and then I was on a plane to his funeral in Highland Park. And for the next 3.5 weeks, I was trying to frantically bring myself up to speed on his life because I didn't know him. I didn't really know all that much about him other than here's this genius, one of many on the internet. And it was this sort of massive cram session. And when all was said and done, I had this 15,000 word article that took 3.5 weeks to research and write. And it was the first major article about him. And amazingly, once it was out, I started telling myself, you know what? I'm only scratching the surface of this story, which seems insane.
It's a long story.
It's the longest thing I've ever written for periodicals by a wide margin. But I started realizing, you know, this story basically just tells his life story chronologically. And that's a compelling story. But the broader story here really deserves explication, too. Sort of the story of how the laws that ensnared him came to be the way that they are, and how academic research of the sort that he was, you know, trying to download came to be sort of considered private property.
Yeah, it's a fascinating look at copyright and free culture, quote unquote, and the people who came before, because Aaron, even at a young age, was a disciple of some other big free culture proponents that were bringing this concept to us that the internet should be about connection and it should be about free exchange of ideas.
Yeah, exactly. You've got Richard Stallman, the free software guy. Lawrence Lessig, the law professor, who's very big in free culture. And even predating them, this guy Michael Hart from Champaign-Urbana, who invented this website called Project Gutenberg. It was the first sort of repository for e-books. Even dating back before that, Noah Webster, the dictionary pioneer. And I started realizing the story of free culture isn't just an internet story. Mm-hmm. It's an American story dating back all the way to before, the Nation's Eye Foundation. And the book just sort of digs into that and surfaces some characters and personalities that sort of exist in an unbroken line with Aaron Swartz.
Aaron was a child prodigy of sorts. I mean, from an early age, and we're talking 11, 12, 13, he seemed to not only be way ahead of his time, but but he was questioning authority. He didn't want to be in school.
No, he didn't want to be in school. To be clear, neither did I. Neither did any of us, you know.
Right. But the way he argued it was different.
Exactly. Like, well, the rest of us were like, school's a prison. We don't want to be there. And our parents were like, sorry, dude, you are a kid. When Aaron was like, school's a prison. I don't want to be here. His parents were basically like, well, you are actually presenting a compelling case.
He made a very compelling case.
For why, like, this school that you're in is not suited to your educational needs. So, yeah, we're going to let you withdraw. And he left formal schooling after his freshman year in high school. He spent the next 3 years taking some classes at Lake Forest College, but mainly pursuing his own education on the internet, reading whatever he could, and really immersing himself in the knowledge communities that he found online.
Well, you wrote about this in the Slate article as well, but the idea that he really went after bureaucracy and organizational, just the way things are set up, big, big companies, whether it be schools or whether it be the government, whatever it was, he looked at trying to improve upon bureaucracies and what was happening around him in big government.
He had a lot of the efficiency expert in him in that, you know, when he saw sort of a structure that didn't really work to its, you know, best capacity, be it secondary education or Silicon Valley, he would go ahead and say, you know what, I've got a better way that we can do this. And big organizations, you know, typically tend to resist, you know, teenagers telling them, you know, right, how to do things better. You know, he would sort of press his point as best he could. And then inevitably he'd come to a point where he'd be like, peace out, guys. And he'd go his own way. And that happened in high school. That happened in college. He spent a year in Stanford. It didn't suit him, and he dropped out to found a company. That company eventually turned into Reddit. He was around when Condé Nast, the magazine publisher, bought the website for somewhere between $10 and $20 million.
Yeah, he got a nice payout.
If you or I or pretty much anyone listening, I presume, would have gotten that big payout at age 19, right on the cusp of the birth of the social web, I know myself, I've been like, sweet, I'm a made man. And I would have stayed there and kept on cashing those paychecks and trying to get more. No, he didn't. And this was like the sort of beautiful and frustrating thing about him. He would consistently make decisions that were against his own best interest, against his own financial best interest. He found himself at Reddit, and the first month after the company had been acquired, he would blog about how unhappy he was, how he would find himself crying in the office bathroom, how there was so much sort of noise, it was hard to think.
And then we're talking about a kid who's 19, 20 years old.
And like eventually he got to the point where he's like, this is just not for me. I'm not making the world a better place by being here. I want to be doing something more impactful.
Now, you know, from the early days of trying to understand free culture and being a quote unquote prodigy, he socially seemed to go out of his way to separate himself. He was not a guy who was a life of the party.
No, actually, he was very bad at parties. He blogged about his freshman year at Stanford from like the standpoint of an anthropologist studying some vulgar foreign culture.
Right. Not
like
a good thing to do in college.
No, not a good thing to
when
do.
When you're a freshman, right?
there's this like really sort of telling blog entry where these two girls who lived on his floor came up to him and tried to sit next to him at breakfast. And he was like, why are you sitting next to me? I'm reading a book. And they're like, well, Aaron, this is what friends do. They sit and talk. And he was like, but this book is filled with useful information. And they were like, okay. So
let us teach you.
Yeah.
They said people are going to start resenting you.
Yeah. People are going to start resenting you even more than they already do. So he wasn't the life of the party. But the interesting thing was like when he went online, you know, he was the center of attention. When he was around other serious people who were like him, interested in working together towards specific actionable projects, then he really came alive.
Justin Peters. He's the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz, and The Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. You know, we talked about Aaron, and I want to talk about his role in free culture. And not only do you know with Creative Commons, but what he studied and what he was doing when ultimately he was indicted for what he did at MIT. We'll talk more about that and the story of Aaron Swartz when we come back here in The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Justin Peters. He's the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz, and The Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. He's also a correspondent for Slate and a contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. You know, it's interesting because he really was Aaron, you know, who took his own life at the age of 26. because he was people around him saying he was so caught up and emotionally damaged from and mentally drained from the indictments from the federal government. He really truly believed in what we call free culture.
Yeah, and this started at a very young age. When he was like 14 or 15, he was substantively involved in building this website called Creative Commons, which was the brainchild of this guy, Lawrence Lessig, one of the intellectual godfathers of the Internet Free Culture movement. What Creative Commons basically is, it presents an easier way for people to share content with other people that might want to use it. It's sort of an alternative to strict black and white copyright, which says that something is either protected all the way or it's not. What Creative Commons does is presents shades of gray in the middle. Like if I take a picture and maybe I say, okay, you guys can use this picture on your own website. You don't have to pay me anything, but just make sure you credit me. And Creative Commons just gave the world an easier way to put those labels on
work. And in a way, that's how the internet was designed to be. The idea that we would share ideas and you could use my work and I could use yours. And this was the, and at a certain point, it became commerce or it became, you know, more and more people started to use it, became mainstream. That idea kind of shrank.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you can sort of see it start to shrink right as the commercial potential of the web becomes, you know, evident right around the turn of the century. And people are like, we can use this new device to sell hats, you know, or to get people interested in our cheese. Or those are the only two things that people buy online.
Right.
At least me.
We, you're making a profile of yourself. Yeah. Hats and cheese.
I'm the hats and cheese guy. but no, right, it totally started to shift. And the values on which the sort of early web were built, this collaboration and altruism, not to say that those were the only values, but back when no one was using the internet other than just a bunch of nerds and professors, it was easier to find ways to use it for just general purposes instead of like commercial ones.
And in the book and your research, you talk about how that is happening, and Aaron is almost becoming a quote-unquote freedom fighter in the way that he's saying, you know, he's becoming more and more the spokesperson. And there's not a lot that are saying, this is supposed to be free. This is supposed to be how the internet works. And all you're seeing and you know, is stuff behind paywalls and stuff and content and academic research and other things being copywritten.
Well, like, there's not a lot of people saying it and actually meaning it, you know. It's easy to say information, you know, wants to be free and have there be a slogan and a presentation for like a venture capitalist to fund your website that actually is just designed to make money.
Right.
But like Aaron was there and he said, you know what, this I'm opting out of Silicon Valley and I'm actually going to devote myself toward projects that actually do try to make information free for all. And starting in 2007, really going on to the end of his life, that was one of his foremost projects.
Thing.
Yeah.
And he seemed to move from just sort of being into the idea of free culture to political. He ended up being a big activist against SOBO, which was the big congressional movement to try and restrict access on the web. He seemed to be more involved in trying to take on the concept of copyright.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he sort of realized that access to information is an inherently political issue. You know, the world sort of runs on information, good or bad, and for someone who is so obsessed with changing the world and making it more equitable like Aaron was, he realized the only way you change the world is by changing men's minds, and the only way you do that is by giving them the information sort of necessary to be able to sort of think things through and change their minds.
One big part of transformative in that you talk about is he goes with Professor Lessig to the Supreme Court as they argue copyright. There was a movement to extend copyright law or the quote-unquote copyright. I think Disney runs by this.
Yeah. Well, they called it the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act because Sonny from Sonny and Cher was a congressman until he died in a tragic skiing accident. And he said before he died, well, copyright should be eternal. And in his memory, his former colleagues effectively decided to try to grant his wish. And you mentioned Disney. This was back in the mid-90s, right when the copyright on Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck was
expiring.
Yeah, it was expiring.
Because they say 50 years, right? That's what the
it used to be. Yeah, it was 70 years back then.
Yeah,
but like so in the late 90s Disney's like, whoa, we got all these theme parks, yeah, based on It's a Small World and Mickey Mouse, and if our copyright on those characters expires and literally any joker can open up their own theme
Mickey
park
Mouse
with Mickey
thing,
Mouse
yeah.
and Donald Duck, that's going to kill us. So they passed this Copyright Term Extension Act, and Lawrence Lessig brings this case to the Supreme Court to challenge it and to say that by extending copyright this long, that it basically goes against the Constitution. And Aaron, at 15 years old, flies out to Washington, D.C., camps out on the steps of the Supreme Court overnight with a bunch of other people he knew through the internet, makes his way into the gallery for the arguments. And this was really his, like, political awakening. If you can imagine, like, a young, smart, impressionable kid watching, like, these in this great hall of justice, like, it really sort of set him on a path.
Consumed's not maybe not the right word, but it seemed to be what pushed him was the fight against copyright and making sure that the internet didn't fall to big interest, to copyright interest, to people who are essentially making money off of information.
Yeah, no, that definitely pushed him. And especially because you remember, like, this was a kid that stepped away from formal schooling and really was sort of autodidactic in the way that he taught himself. And I think he realized that, look, being able to access interesting and good information online has been so helpful to me. Other people should be able to have these same opportunities. He was very much an idealist in that sense. Of course, you know, idealism isn't always particularly pragmatic, and I don't think he ever really accepted or sort of understood that. And when you get to the story of his end, that's the fundamental tension, this idealism of, you know, let's improve the world by giving people, right, you know, more good information, clashing with the pragmatism of, okay, but this stuff is actually owened. And
people are making their
livelihoods. People are making their livelihoods.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. Okay, let's take a quick break for the news, and we'll come back with Justin Peters. He's the author of The Idealist, Aaron Schwartz, and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. We got to talk about what Aaron did that got him in so much trouble when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Justin Peters. He's the author of The Idealist, Aaron Schwartz, and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. Correspondent at Slate as well. He wrote about it for Slate right after the Aaron Schwartz's suicide. You know, we're talking about free culture, copyright, and essentially Aaron's idea of quote-unquote being a freedom fighter. That took him to a place where he started to kind of wade into gray waters when it comes to the law, illegally downloading things from Pacer, which I know Pacer. It's amazing that he did that. But then also, you know, what he did at MIT. Let's start with Pacer. What was his thought here?
So Pacer is this gigantic database of U.S. federal courts records, and it's a tremendous sort of resource for journalists or researchers or anyone who sort of wants to find out anything about a federal case. But sort of a clunky interface the website is, and it's also you have to pay
it
to
costs
use
money,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 10 cents per page, and it doesn't sound like much, but some of these transcripts are like hundreds of pages. It adds up.
And it almost flies in the face of what we're seeing now with big government or government in general, even the city of Chicago, who's trying to be transparent and journalists want the information. This is, Pacer says, you can have the information, but it's going to cost you federal government papers.
Yeah, exactly. Papers that like literally belong to the public. These are public records. And Aaron and this other guy named Carl Malamud, who's this legendary public data activist out on the West Coast, they started working together to try to liberate this Pacer data. There was this trial program that the U.S. courts were running where if you went to one of 16 federal depository libraries around the country and logged into a computer there, you could download as much as you wanted for free. And what Aaron did is he sent a friend to one of these libraries and downloaded this thing called an authentication cookie, which is basically just a digital key card. Mm-hmm. And he used that from his home in Massachusetts to fool the system into thinking that he was sitting at this computer in Sacramento. And once he did that, he started automatically downloading millions and millions of documents, and he eventually got almost 20% of the database, which at the time was 20 million pages, before the feds realized that something was happening, and they cut off his access.
They cut off the access, but there really wasn't a law that he broke because they were offering it for free download. If anything, it was just the idea that he had found accelerated ways to download. But talk about, at that point, he got the attention of the FBI.
He did. The FBI began a file on him. He had crashed the U.S. court's computers, and They weren't quite sure what his motivations were. So they started researching, you know, his life. They went on his website, you know, they learned about his stated intentions to sort of liberate all of this data and make it free for the world. They sent a car to drive by his parents' house in Highland Park. And then they actually called him up and they said, look, we want you to come in and meet with us. And we just want to know what you did and get some advice on how to get the Pacer system back up and running. And like they said, trust us. If it was anything more than that, we wouldn't have called to ask.
Right.
And he didn't trust them. Why should he? And he had his lawyer call them and say, my client will come to meet with you if you can guarantee that no negative consequence will come to him as a result of it. And they couldn't guarantee it, so he never met. Mm-hmm. And they closed the case because no law had been broken. But it brought him to their attention.
Yeah, and they paid attention. Aaron, like we talked about, got political, and he fought and for activism, and he did a wonderful job with SOPA, which was another one of the congressional movements to restrict certain websites in the United States. And he was a big part of, as an activist, to say, let's not make that happen. And he was great at raising awareness because of his skills on the Internet.
I've talked to a lot of the people who were involved in the sort of Stop SOPA protests, and you know, they all say, you know, without Aaron and like his help and expertise, the protest never would have come together. He built all these sort of widgets that helped people contact their Congress people and tell them vote against this bill. He gave a lot of speeches trying
demand
to
demand progress.
Demand progress. Yeah. Basically, he was trying to get the average Internet user who checks the basketball scores and likes their uncle's, you know, pictures on Facebook to think about the political dimensions of what they're doing and to sort of realize that the Internet isn't the way it is just, you know, naturally, that, you know, there are policies that are discussed and passed mm-hmm. or denied in, you know, Congress that can affect the sorts of websites you're able to access
or
not.
It's interesting argument, too, he made in a speech I saw online where he talked about the idea that this is all about copyright. Once again, people are protecting their copyright and money that's made off that information. And there's a lot of little things that people can say, you know what, I don't like justinpeters.com because he's using code that's copyrighted, so it's restricted by the U.S. government. And that's what he was trying to argue, that, you know, on first glance, the sites that they would want to restrict, we look at and say, yeah, maybe you should restrict that, pornography or whatever it is. But there are these little loopholes that give the U.S. government the ability to say, I don't like Justin Peters. Justin Peters borrows this code from whatever. That's copyrighted. He's out.
I mean, like, these laws are so broadly construed that, like, you might not think that will ever happen, but there's a lot of things, like, you think will never happen that end up happening.
Right.
You know, like, you might never think that the, you know, feds are going to, you know, bring 13 felony counts against a guy like Aaron Swartz just for downloading some papers, but they did.
They did because that law, and we're going to get there right now. So Aaron turns his attention to academic research. Now, this is something I didn't know until this happened, until Aaron Swartz's story brought it up. But there are academic research is copywritten, and for big universities to be able to get at that research, they got to pay for it.
Yeah, so the academic publishing world is super interesting. When a professor, you know, writes a research paper, she doesn't do so for thought of profit, right? There's no sense that this is ever going to become a bestseller.
She's getting paid by the university.
She's getting paid by the university. Right. Yeah, maybe her research is publicly funded. So she assigns the copyright over to an academic publisher. And in exchange for that, the publisher's like, we're going to publish your work, we'll disseminate it, we'll help get it read. And this was the trade-off, like, for years, like in years back before the Internet. Now that the Internet comes along, a lot of professors, it's called the open access movement, are saying, well, what do we need the publisher for?
Just put it online.
Let's just put it online, and, you know, I'm not making any money, don't expect to. Let's let the world access this. And a lot of these publishers and database providers are like, well, great idea in theory, but let me remind you, we hold the copyright for all of these papers. And copyright now in America lasts until 70 years after the author's death.
Right.
So we're not putting this stuff up, even if it might make the world a better place.
Because we're making money off
it. We're making money off of it, exactly. And like, to be clear, I have nothing wrong with making money.
No.
But it's the sort of thing where...
But this is information. And making money off of information is different of making money off of product.
Yeah.
I think that Aaron's point was this information is being you know, people who with means can, and whether it be university or anybody who has the means can get it. But people who don't are banned from basic information that's being learned at the university level.
And I'll tell you a story. When I was researching this book, there was all this sort of information, all of these old papers and documents that I was never able to access, you know, because I'm not affiliated with any school. You know, I don't have institutional access. And I can't help thinking, you know, how much better, like, my book might have been if I had been able to just log right. on to these databases, like, and get it. But I don't have several hundreds of dollars to get every single...
Well, so Aaron goes in and he says, I know how I can get it inside the, what's it, it's called JSTOR.
JSTOR,
right?
Yeah.
So I can get inside of that. I know how to hack into that. I'm going to download all the information. So he goes and he creates, through MIT,
yeah.
he goes and he starts to download all the information from this academic publishing JSTOR website, quickly draws the attention once again of the feds.
Well, yeah, I mean, within hours, he draws the attention of JSTOR and MIT, and they try to cut off his access, and then he sort of logs on again. They cut off his access again. It becomes this months-long cat-and-mouse game. And sort of finally, in January of 2011, the Secret Service gets involved, and they're like, listen, we've located the computer that's downloading this. We don't know who it is, but let's, you know, set up some cameras and see if we can figure that out. And they film this white male with dark wavy hair coming in to retrieve the laptop.
It was in a closet.
It was in a basement closet in some MIT building.
It's like straight out of what you would know from a hacker movie. It's the same thing. He covers his face. And
yeah.
He goes in and out of this closet.
You can just hear sort of like the soundtrack, like in the background, the bum, bum, bum. But they catch him. And like there's a foot chase. They arrest him. He's 100 feet from his apartment when they finally cuff him and bring him into the station. And they find that he had downloaded about 5 million of these documents. All academic papers, and then they initially charge him just with breaking and entering, but they start thinking of ways to try to charge him with more.
Unfortunately for Aaron and for the case, it almost becomes a poster child kind of situation where the U.S. government, the feds, the Justice Department, they throw the book at him. 13 felony counts for essentially what, under this law of quote-unquote computer crime. They're talking about 50 years. It really feels, when you look back at it and you read, they wanted to make this an example.
Yeah, they definitely did. And you got to remember, this is happening right around the time that WikiLeaks is in the headlines. And, you know, the government and anyone with secrets, you know, is starting to get nervous about people finding new ways to access those secrets. So even though what Aaron Swartz was doing was very different from, you know, what Julian Assange mm-hmm. or, you know, Chelsea Manning were doing, like they definitely saw him right in that same...
And they had him.
Yeah, they had him. Like, he wasn't in Sweden. Yeah,
right,
yeah, like,
right.
So like,
so it's almost like he took on the crimes of the others that you just mentioned. So like, the government's like, we have this guy, so let's send a message.
Yeah, I think there's some real truth in that. And I also think it's the sort of thing where a lot of people don't differentiate between the types of computer crimes that we should all oppose, like getting people's credit card numbers mm-hmm. or identity
phishing.
Theft.
Yeah,
right, phishing. Right, well, that's, right, listen, right. I've fallen for internet scams in my day. Like, I like want those people to go to jail. And like the other sorts of crimes, it's basically just trying to help people pursue like their educations. And there's this sort of willful reluctance to differentiate. It's just like if you use a computer and committed a crime, then it's a computer
right.
crime. And that sort of intransigence really is what caught him up.
So Aaron Swartz, you know, he's 26 at this time. He moves to New York. He was living in Boston. He has to keep going back to Boston for the hearings. The government just not letting up on this. It starts to take an emotional and mental toll. Aaron falls victim to depression.
Yeah. I mean, I think any one of us, you know, would start to feel the pressure after, you know, a couple of years of a case that will not go away and sort of being increasingly aware that
all his money's gone.
Yeah, all his money's
zapping
gone.
Him, all the lawyers,
yeah, they're
everything.
Zapping him. And all this time, he doesn't think he did anything wrong, you know? So he starts, the pressure starts to get to him. And what's crazy is that right near like the last week of his life, he takes his girlfriend up to the roof of their building in Brooklyn. And they look out on Prospect Park, and they live right near where the old Ebbets Field was. And they're looking out, and he says, you know, this is going to be an excellent year. And throughout that whole week, the week before he died, there were all these signs that he was right. his lawyer. He had a new lawyer.
Mm-hmm. There was some optimism.
Yeah, there was some optimism. They had hope that they would be able to suppress a bunch of evidence the government wanted to use. His relationship with his girlfriend had never been better. He was engaged, like, in his work. It felt like, you know, the tide might actually, like, be turning, which is why it's so sort of wrenching that he hanged himself.
You know, for Aaron Swartz and his legacy, and this is the one thing to take from Aaron's work is, you know, child prodigy from here in Highland Park, and to know that he had been such a tireless fighter for this kind of internet. Does it surprise you that his 3 years after the fact that people are still talking about, people want to come out and buy this book or come watch you talk about Aaron Swartz? Is it surprising to you that his legacy lives on?
Yeah. It actually sort of is, in all the best ways, you know, because, you know, Aaron's story, while, you know, really sort of like touching, like, and tragic, it's also not the only story of its kind, you know. There's all sorts of people who've been sort of imprisoned unjustly or whose lives have been sort of like cut short, who have done great things and might have gone on to do greater things. And, you know, life is busy and, you know, the world is filled with news, and, you know, I would not have been surprised if, you know, this story had become one of those that, you know, you're walking down the street and you're like, what was that guy's name? Aaron, you know, Aaron's, I don't know, you know?
Right.
But the fact that it persists, I think, really testifies to both, like, what sort of a sad story it is, and also the fact that, like, the issues that he was interested in continue to sort of be unresolved and continue to interest literally everybody who has ever downloaded, like, a song online or watched a YouTube video or left a comment somewhere, to realize that, like, the line between the government coming for Aaron Swartz and them coming for you is a lot more thin than you might want to believe.
Justin Peters is the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. Thanks so much for being my guest tonight on The Download.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hitting the halfway point here on The Download. As we hit the 9 o'clock hour, coming up, we're going to talk about the 30th anniversary of New City, great alt-weekly publication here in Chicago that's both in print and online. Also coming up, State Senator Daniel Biss. Talk to him about the flashing lights this week in Springfield. And then at 10 o'clock, it's the frying pan. Steve Gadlin, local entrepreneur, the man behind IWantToDrawACatForYou.com, is back in the hot seat. He's got a new idea this week. And we're going to, as Download Nation, yay or nay, 312-981-7200. For that, great conversation there about the legacy of Aaron Swartz. You know, I had a chance when I was producer, this would have been, geez, 2000?
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been, 16, that's crazy, man, 16 years ago. Maybe a little bit, maybe like 2001. Anyway, right around that time. Aaron Swartz is from this area. He grew up in either Highland Park or on the North Shore.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a segment on a show that was like a tech corner. I think it was like a Mondays. And Lou Cook, who was an old tech reporter, would be the contributor, and he would do the interviews. And he interviewed Aaron when he was 13 years old, maybe even younger.
Jeez.
And it was all about this sort of computer prodigy stuff. It was just great. And I know when Aaron died, we went and found that. I had to go through, like, unfortunately, you know, same with the New City stuff. I mean, if you go online, you can't find the Schadenfreude cover. Like, it's gone. Like, it's like, digital archives have changed over the years, and it's the same if you go to WGN or any other radio station. But I know that the NPR station's archives, they're not online. So I had to go to, I mean, it was like a library. I found the old roadmaps, and I went through every single day looking for that interview, and I found it, and then I cross-referenced, and I found the old CD that it was on.
Ugh.
And got it. But it was amazing to go back and hear that.
Him?
Yeah, I mean, it was, the kid was, he obviously at such a young age was something special. And, you know, I think because that was used in his obituary stuff, like the legacy conversations back in 2013 when he died,
mm-hmm.
that if you looked it up now on Google, you could find Like, because I think that they pulled it and made it, you know, like sort of like, remember this.
Yeah.
So I don't think you'll find the original broadcast from 2001, but you can hear in 2013 the reminiscent sort of stuff. But it's eerie to think about.
Yeah.
You know, especially since he had such a tremendous, life in such a short amount of time.
Incredible.
It really, I mean, I didn't do it justice in the interview with Justin because we talked more about what happened to him and why he got in trouble with the federal government. But there's a whole part of that book, the first half, just about him being a computer prodigy.
Yeah. Don't you wish you were a genius?
Well, it's fascinating to me, Pete, because, you know, we have all these interviews and we talk to artists and we talk to people who are celebrities. And you come in and you go, when did you start? We're talking to Vic Wooten, the bass player.
Yeah.
And when I was four, I was playing bass and I was on tour with my brothers. What?
Yeah, I know.
Four, five. Yeah, when I picked it up when I was 6 years old, I started hanging out in the studio. I mean, if anything, it's interesting to see that a lot of people we interview who have done miraculous or spectacular things with their life started at such a young age.
Incredible.
Right? It's like, that's kind of what I'm learning from this show, is that there really is a connection to this sort of child prodigy. If you really got it when you're 4 years old, you're flaunting it when you're 25, so... There you go. So coming up, the second half of the download tonight, stay with us. Hey, it's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight when Patty Vasquez takes over. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. Well, New City, one of Chicago's go-to alt weeklies, is celebrating a milestone. Yesterday, they put out their big 30th anniversary edition. This is getting prominent Chicagoans to talk about what life might be like 30 years from now in 2046. New City began in Chicago as a printed product, but in the last few years, it's also been a website, although they still do the printed magazine, which is twice a month. New City's been one of the great places for arts and culture coverage here in the city, including theater, literature, comedy, and one of, if not the first publication to cover music in Chicago. It's published by Brian and Jan Hagelke, and Brian is in studio with me tonight. Brian, good to see you.
Hey, Justin.
Congratulations. 30 years.
Thank you.
How about that?
It's something. It's something. I'm not sure what, but it's something.
Well, you know, let's talk about that because, you know, you put this out. This is a big accomplishment for any media company in Chicago to be around for 30 years. It's great. Just on page three, you have, you know, the first days of showing Harold Washington what New City is. Talk about what a day like today or this milestone means to you.
You know, it's always interesting getting old, right? I mean, it's like you're very happy about what you've done, but you're also, you know, sort of very measured in the way I think you approach it. But, you know, and that's why when we decided to do an anniversary issue, I was much more interested in thinking about the future than the past. You know, it's just kind of the nature of what we've always been about. It's always been about tomorrow, not yesterday.
Yeah, and I mean, you could easily be lured into the idea of doing a retrospective on New City because so many great writers and so many great stories have come out of this publication. But you chose to look forward and get prominent Chicagoans to comment on what they think 2046 is going to look like. Why make that choice?
Well, you know, that's a little bit of a statement that we plan to be around in 2046
<There you go. laughs>
and still in print, even, you know, as far as we're concerned. And, you know, I think maybe for our 50th anniversary, we can do a look back. So, you know, we'll save that for that one.
Talk about why you got into this, because when you weren't in media when you started New City, you were actually into music. But, you know, this was, I would think that would be more of a hobby. You actually come from a finance background.
Yeah, I mean, you know, basically we got into this. It was myself, my wife, Jan, and my younger brother, Brent. We were all either just out of or still in the University of Chicago at the time. Had moved into the Printers Row area of Chicago, which then was, you know, a real frontier. No one lived in the South Loop at that point other than the real pioneers. And, you know, I was working at Goldman Sachs, which is, you know, now a bad word, but back then it was a fairly prestigious thing to do. And, you know, it just seemed like we should start a newspaper. The neighborhood needed one. And so we started, like, you know, and that's the nice thing about being 22 or 23 years old is that, you know, you sort of have that hubris to just say, you know what, we can figure this out. We don't need to have experience. Let's just do it. And we did it. And it's not the way I ever recommend young people start businesses because...
How so? Know, what do you mean?
Well, you still get experience. It's just on your own dime instead of someone else's. Right. And that's a big difference, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a big part of what sets something like New City apart and why it can stay around for 30 years is because it is independent. It's not being traded and moved around from company to company, as you see with some other things that are that are like this, that are done by some of the more major media companies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we hadn't been independent, I'm sure we'd be dead at this point. Just because knock on wood, even though there's none of it around here, the last 3 years have been good. We're actually growing, which for a print publishing company is an unusual thing to be able to say. But the 10 years before that were terrible. And, we've seen everybody from, the Chicago Tribune to the Sun-Times, to the Chicago Reader. At one point, they were all in bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. They're all still around, thankfully. But, it's been a rough decade. And our ability to change a lot, which is what we've done, made a big difference.
I'm so interested in because, New City is that alt weekly, and it's that kind of that has the spirit of an independent alt weekly. And you've seen so many different publications go after you, and I mean go after you and your audience, and go after that kind of feel, whether it be Red Eye or Red Streak at the Sun Times, or you have had a healthy competition with the Reader over the years. But they're really, because of your success and the Reader's success in sort of bringing the alt weekly to this audience, a lot of people want in on the business.
Yeah, not as much as they used to when we were both running like hundreds of pages of ads. But, it's still a very compelling thing to do because, we work very hard. But, our work is all about culture and the city we live in and love. And there are far worse jobs you could have than to do what we do. So I think and the urge to write and to make art and to create is a very, sort of compelling thing. So. A lot of times I think it gets romanticized and people think, oh, I should, I'd love to do this. And then they try and they realize how hard it is to make it work as a business, which is the way it works mostly in America.
Well, let me ask you, when you got into it, 1986, and you decided with your wife and your younger brother, what did you know about alt weeklies? What was it that, at that point where you're like, oh, we should get into this business. What did you know about that culture?
Nothing at all. In fact, we always say that none of us ever set foot into a publication's offices until we started one. And I actually didn't even know the Reader existed. I grew up and I was in that demographic. I had lived in New York when I was training at Wall Street, though, and really loved the Village Voice, which is the mm-hmm. sort of the, mm-hmm. the granddaddy of them all, as they say, and fell in love with that sort of really brash attitude that the Village Voice had. And when I came into Chicago and we started New City, first as just a little neighborhood paper, we're like, hey, the South Loop needs a paper. And it does, 30 years later, maybe. But at the time, it was a little bit early. And we thought we were really interested in the cultural life of the city. And it just sort of two things happened. One is somebody pointed out the Reader and how successful it was. At that point, it was like four sections and it was like, brick.
Right.
And two, I realized that I was in its core demographic and had no interest in reading it, which meant there was an opportunity to create something that was very different. I grew to respect what it stood for in those days and everything, but it wasn't a publication that spoke to me. And so that created the opportunity in my mind, but we evolved. We didn't come out. There was no business plan. I mean, we decided like at Thanksgiving that we should start a newspaper and had their first issue out with no experience by the beginning of February, so this was just, like I said, it was a lot of youthful energy.
And you said the early days you were covering the South, or it was a neighborhood paper for the South Loop, Printers Row, where you guys were at, but before it was called South Loop. But talk about what was its focus. I mean, you keep talking about culture in Chicago. What did you think you did well back in 1986?
I guess that we didn't stand out in any way that yet, but except for the fact that we were covering an area that was very interesting. There was a lot of activity. Our very first cover story was about the city's plans to put a brand new White Sox stadium in the South Loop, which, of course no one remembers that anymore, but it was a very controversial idea. We took the neighborhood and we took our writing and journalism and everything very seriously and created very high standards from the very beginning. And, by doing that, you know, I think we set the foundation of where we're going to go. And because we are downtown in the South Loop, the culture of sort of the greater downtown was always fair game for us. So we covered it a lot right away. You know, we were the Art Institute and the Museum of Contemporary Photography, which had its 40th anniversary last night, you know, was an early passion of ours. So, you know, those are the sorts of things. We covered house music as a cover story in probably 1986 or 7, I'm not sure, you know, because the store where Frankie Knuckles and all these guys bought all their records was in Printer's Row back then. And
I remember that store.
Yeah.
I went to Columbia College, and I was probably in there 1991, 1990, in that kind of time. So I feel like, I have a feel for what you guys were doing at that time. It's a great little area.
Yeah.
Brian Hegelke is the publisher of New City, along with his wife, Jan. You know, let's take a break. We'll take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you about how the media landscape has changed, but also the business. Because you guys, as you just mentioned, you know, the decade was rough. But it seems like you've come out of it. Things are going better. But I want to get a sense for what you had to do, what changes you had to make to New City to keep it vibrant. We'll talk with Brian Hegelke some more here on The Download when we come back. Stay with us. Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, talking about New City, 30th anniversary. Congratulations, Brian. Brian Hegelke is the publisher, along with his wife, Jan. 30 years of doing this paper, this Alt Weekly, which went from a Printer's Row neighborhood newspaper to really a paper that covers the heart and soul of Chicago, the arts and culture. I mean, obviously, you've done great political work and you've done a lot of feature stories, but the sections that people remember, at least in my mind, over the 30 years has been art, has been theater, comedy, music. I mean, you seem to find a way to really get at the pulse of what makes a city tick.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. It's partly because that was what our personal passions were, and that's the nice thing, I guess, about running your own show is you get to do what you love, that's taken us into some weird directions over the years, but I think that's also hopefully kept it a little bit fresher because it never was like focus grouped or anything like that. You know?
Well, you've been in a situation where to be able to put out this material every week, and now it's twice a month, but. But the idea of doing this every week, you had to rely on freelancers. You had to rely on a lot of different writers here in Chicago who were working in other places. But talk about that relationship with the freelance writing community here in Chicago. A lot of great writers have come through your doors.
Yeah, kind of getting back to what we were saying before, in the early days, we very quickly established that we were going to be as high quality as we could be, even though we had no money and no knowledge and no skills. That sort of paid off so that over time we became the go-to place for the young kids who are just, trying to get a start in the world as writers who had a lot of talent but maybe hadn't had a lot of opportunity left. And we would yet. And because we were so young and we started it, who were we to say you have to have a lot of experience before you're good? We that's always been fundamental to our belief is that good is good from day one and you can do it. And because of that, we had a lot of great writers spend some time with us and artists and everything else. Chris Ware, obviously, right. Very famously did a lot of work for us in the 90s and, before he became known as the greatest cartoonist in the history of mankind. we've had so many different writers do great things. And right now, actually, one of our early guys is back doing a column for us, Tony Fitzpatrick, who was both an artist and a writer.
Yeah.
Who's sort of taken much of that journey with us in different ways in different times.
But. Well, let's talk about, the journey that you've had for 30 years has been up and down because you've been victim to the thing that's happened to a lot of media companies. The landscape has changed. The advertising kind of bottomed out. A lot of companies have moved to just web only, things of that nature. Talk about what you've had to do to survive when it comes to being a media company.
You don't want to know all of it, but ultimately it comes down to a lot of grit and persistence. On the business side, what we did at a certain point in time and said we used to have a big office with a lot of desks and staff members and computers and, huge rent bill. And, as we saw what was happening, we said, the world's changed. We can be a virtual operation. We don't need brick and mortar to operate it. And so we put everything into the cloud, everything we do, from designing it, everything that's done. Ironically, it's a tangible publication that has, that has no tangible creation. It's like all done virtually. And that's brought our cost structure down dramatically and made it very flexible. But the other key thing for us was, I'm very optimistic about the future of print. I think mm-hmm. it's going to be around for a long time, just like vinyl records have come back and everything else. But I don't think that means everybody's going to be around for a long time. I think it's a very Darwinian time, and you really have to figure out what it's going to take to survive. And for us, that meant figuring out what our core mission was, what our core, what we were really good at and what it mattered to us. And, we sort of adopted the mantra that we wanted to be the publication of record for Chicago culture. We just said we want to be the go-to voice for culture because we can't be everything to everybody. Right. And that has worked out very well.
Let me ask you, because I just had a conversation just this last 2 weeks about startup culture, media startup here in Chicago, the news that Touch Vision was shutting down, and we kind of looked at the sort of murderer's row of different media startups that didn't get off the ground. You are one of the media companies that did and spent 30 years in Chicago being able to publish New City. What's your advice to somebody who wants to get into the business of media in Chicago here in 2016?
Think again. No, it really depends what they want to do. I think the technology-driven media world is very compelling and also incredibly challenging. We really, I love technology. My family, my father's a physicist. My brothers, are all in the science and technology world. It's in my blood. I love it. But I'm not at all, any kind of...
You're not a Luddite.
No, right, any kind of a Luddite. Right. But so I love innovating on the web and doing things there, but it's absolutely still very challenging to figure out how to make money on it if you're not a transactional business, i.e., if you're Amazon.com or something like that, except for Google and Facebook.
Do you see that changing? I mean, because you've been in the business of getting people to take ads out in New City. That's the primary way that you're going to get money. And we were talking about this, that we haven't seen that transition. There's not a huge market for web advertising, even though there are ads and we are frustrated as consumers about how ads are used. It still hasn't translated from how it is in newspapers. How do you see that? Do you see a world where that actually catches up to itself?
I think a lot of people are banking on it. And certainly, Google and Facebook are making enormous. Facebook reported yesterday a quarterly profit of $1 billion. Profit, and most of that's advertising driven. So what's happened is Google and Facebook have just, hoovered up all of the ad dollars that exist on the internet. Their models are very different. They're not content driven models. They're service driven models, right? It's, Facebook, the content that we read on Facebook comes from those of us in the world that are creating content, not from Facebook itself. And I think that's the real challenge. And I think the jury is still out. If you'd asked me this question 10 years ago, we actually did, many, many war stories we could tell if we had all night. We bet the ranch and sort of lost the ranch on the internet in the 90s and with a big startup of our own. And if you'd asked me back then, did I think the future of the internet was going to be advertising driven media? I'd say yes, absolutely.
Of course, right.
Today, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it's the right, that it works as well. I do believe it's going to be a big part of it, but I don't think we don't know the answer yet. So I think if these sort of new startups are thinking about it, you have to be very realistic about how you're going to get your revenue, mm-hmm. because in the olden days of the internet, people just every business that got started was going to be paid for by advertising, and I think you have to be realistic. I've always said about the internet is it's just a parallel universe to the terrestrial world. So it's very similar, right? It's like it's not like some magical behavioral thing is going to change there. So Google is just like the yellow pages of the internet.
Yeah,
it's this new thing.
That's a great way to look at it.
And you just have to kind of think about behavior. And the problem with internet advertising right now, and the one thing we haven't solved, is it's interruptive, and that's why it irritates people. It kind of gets in your way. It interferes with what you're doing. That's why print advertising is great, because it's not, you know, it's like it's a part
it's
of the whole
edges,
thing.
Yeah.
And it's a different page and you can look at it. And a lot of it people like because it's, you know, well designed, doesn't make noise, doesn't, you know. And they've actually gotten rid of most of those stinky perfume ads they used to run. those were the only print ads I would say that really
those were disruptive. Let me ask you as we wrap up here, you know, congrats on 30 years of doing New City. I mean, in the immediate future, what does the future hold for you and Jan and for New City here in Chicago?
Well, you know, there's you know, the core business for us is obviously our primary focus. We're working on redesigning our websites, where we're going to follow that with a redesign of the print publication. And, you know, continuing to invest in sort of the cultural coverage of Chicago. That's our core. Beyond that, we've launched New City Brazil, which is a crazy experiment in, you know, the
cool
globalization of culture in the future. And this summer, we're shooting a feature film.
And I that was well documented when it was announced about a year ago, right?
Yes.
And we should have you back when that gets to the point where we can see it.
Absolutely.
Brian Hegelke and Jan, his wife, are the publishers of New City. New City celebrating their 30th anniversary this week. It's on stands. It's called Chicago 2046. It's a look ahead. Prominent Chicagoans on their take on what Chicago is going to be like in 2046. Brian, thanks for coming in and congrats again.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this week was a big one in Springfield. The state of the state, the vote to fund some higher education, the continued chaos around school funding formulas, and still no budget. What does it all mean? Well, Senator Daniel Biss was one of my first guests here on The Download, and he was such a kid back then. He's a Democrat that represents northern suburbs like Skokie and Glenview, and he's in studio with me tonight after a long week in Springfield.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin. I remember those young, naive, optimistic days before you got in the air and crushed all of our hopes, but it's good to be back.
So let's talk about this week, because, you know, we were able to, you know, get reaction from lawmakers from the state of the state. What'd you think of the speech?
Well, it seems like he's trying to take some steps to tone down some of the rhetoric. He kind of can't help himself from including a few aggressive zingers. But I think he understands that the first year in which he was governor, A, very little was accomplished in a proactive sense, and B, the state started to fall apart. We have no budget. Social service agencies are closing. The higher education infrastructure is crumbling. And I hope that he understands it's time for a reset.
Well, you know, there was a lot of talk, and Representative Sandek was on yesterday saying what he heard was it's an olive branch. He believes that the governor wants to compromise. He wants to work with Democrats, and it's on your guys' shoulders to meet in the middle.
I mean, I don't understand exactly what that means. It's on all of our shoulders to meet in the middle. It's on all of our shoulders to find some point of agreement. Seems to me that a preemptive strike saying in advance, oh, no, we didn't agree because you didn't agree with me, is probably the wrong way to go about it. There's a giant philosophical gap between most legislators, including almost all Democrats and plenty of Republicans on the one hand, and then the rest of the Republicans and the governor on the other hand, around what he calls his turnaround agenda. Those are giant philosophical differences, and if he wants to make progress, he's going to have to convince us gradually, and I look forward to having those discussions. Though I will tell you that some of my views in the opposite direction are very, very deeply held. In the meantime, the state needs a budget, and I think any day that we allow to go by without trying to figure out a way to reach some agreement on how to have a budget that's balanced, that's fair, that's sustainable, that funds the programs that are the priorities of the people of Illinois and that allow us to move forward without having continued fiscal harm inflicted upon the state is a day wasted.
Let me ask you this question, because I get it all the time in texts here at WGN Radio and we hear it here with some of our guests as well. You have the supermajority. Democrats have the ability to pass a budget and sustain be able to get past the governor's veto. So what's stopping Springfield from having a balanced budget?
3 points. Point number one, the Democrats in the Senate have a pretty big supermajority, so it's pretty plausible that we could do that. Not certain, but plausible. We have overridden some gubernatorial vetoes in the Senate. The House, they don't. They've got just the number of votes they need, 71 votes. And so if any one of them isn't on board, they can't override the governor's veto. And that they've not all been on the same page. There's one member in particular who's
got
been
a backpack.
He's got a backpack. He's got a sleeping bag. He's ready to go camping, but he's not ready to vote with the Democrats. And so that's been a challenge. So practically speaking, the Democrats can't override the governor. But here's the other point. The governor is the head of the executive branch of the government. He's got to run the government. If the governor and the General Assembly can't come to agreement on a budget, if the General Assembly is trying to run the state from the legislative chambers, you're heading for disaster anyway, because the guy who's actually executing it isn't on board. The only constructive, reasonable way through this is for the General Assembly and the governor to come to some agreement. What do we view are our top priorities? Mm-hmm. What does it cost to deliver those services? How do we bring in the revenue needed to meet those costs? Now, right now, those conversations aren't happening.
And you had a conversation about this stuff earlier in the spring, summer, where both parties passed an unbalanced budget, billions of dollars out of whack. What's interesting about it, though, is that it all sort of stems to this idea that we need to raise taxes. And Governor Rauner, just this week, you know, last week when he was talking about the CPS takeover, a question was asked me. He's like, Democrats want to raise taxes? Look the taxpayers in the eye and say, I want to raise taxes. Don't be cowards about it. But the question I have is, I saw Pat Quinn do that. I saw Governor Quinn do that 2-3 years ago when he had to do the income tax. Isn't it the job of the governor to step in front of the podium and say, we're going to have to raise taxes to balance the budget?
The job of the governor is to introduce a balanced budget. Literally, his legal obligation is to do that. He doesn't have to say we have to raise taxes. If he doesn't want to raise taxes, he could introduce a balanced budget without a tax increase. The dude has never done that. He's been governor for more than a year and has never introduced a balanced budget. If he thought we shouldn't raise taxes, I presume he would have then told us what the budget should look like that's balanced without a tax increase.
He would say 20% less in spending.
Yeah, he'd say, hey, look, I want to protect this one area, but I want to cut this other area. Here's how we're going to make the difference with cuts only. He won't do that, and the reason he won't do that is because he actually seems to, from what I can tell, want a tax increase, but he doesn't want to admit it. Come on. We need to tell the truth about how we're going to balance the budget and work it out together.
Why
and
do you
accept
think that
it'll
is?
Be
I mean,
hard.
We've already got – I mean, you saw Governor Quinn raise the income tax and it was rolled back, but what is it about – politicians, especially in Springfield, that are just avoid. I mean, is it really that close in terms of being reelected that no one wants to introduce the idea of raising taxes?
You know, there's a couple issues, Justin. Number one, I'm not going to sugarcoat it or defend us. Politicians are risk averse and try to not be out in front too much when it comes to articulating potentially controversial things. But the other thing about the governor is that he really wants to get what he calls his turnaround agenda through. That's his clear priority from what I can tell. So he wants to produce leverage. And so what he's saying is, hey, Democrats, I don't want to do anything on revenue. I don't want to pass a tax reform bill. I don't want to overhaul our tax code. I don't want to find a way to achieve adequate revenue to fund the programmatic spending that we need. But hey, I'll reluctantly agree to do it if you pass my turnaround agenda. So he's staking out a false, I would say dishonest position in order to create this kind of artificial leverage to get something totally unrelated done.
Talking with State Senator Daniel Biss, one of my first guests here on The Download. Good to see you. You're really so stately now. You know, before you had the tie undone, now you're all cleaned up.
I even shaved for you today, Justin.
You did. Back from a crazy week in Springfield, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Senator Biss here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Dan Biss is my guest, state senator from North Suburbs, Skokie, Glenview, Democrat. Was going to run for comptroller, backed off of that. I think you would have made a great comptroller.
I appreciate that. You're
so into math.
I do think that math is one of the top subjects. It's a great subject.
What's morale like down for lawmakers? I mean, it feels to me it would be a very difficult job to sit on your hands the entire time.
It's frustrating. I mean, one thing that I want to say about the great majority of people there, including, by the way, the governor, notwithstanding how much I disagree with him, is that most people are there trying to do something useful. And the fact that we've been in this holding pattern and watching the state decay and be harmed, watching people in our communities be harmed, is not what anybody signed up for. And so that's been frustrating. And I think there is a certain amount of, as you put it, sitting on our hands, and sometimes it feels like we're waiting. At the same time, the only path out of this nightmare is going to be if ideas come from unlikely places. And so as I talk with legislators, as much as the tone is kind of, hey, this is frustrating right now, I wish it were something different, there's also a lot of, how can we help break us out of this
spot?
But
isn't there so much, especially when you talk about the turnaround agenda and Speaker Madigan, you know, there seems to be so much, as Mike Fouché earlier this week said, you know, he said, you know, it's like political chicken. I mean, you guys aren't really being asked to come up with good creative ideas. It's the bosses up top, and when they decide yay or nay, that's when you say yay or nay, right?
I actually think the turnaround agenda is a really interesting opportunity. So what's the turnaround agenda? The governor came into office. He said, hey, look, Illinois's got giant problems, huge debt. We keep incarcerating our governors. Our bond rating is bad. Yeah, we've got to fix these big problems. Right. And he laid out his agenda for how he thought he would fix those problems. Now, I think that his agenda is really dangerous and radical. But I think the question of what is the big visionary agenda to take on the great problems facing the state of Illinois is a very important question. And so that's a question I ask myself all the time. Are the leaders asking me that question on a daily basis? Maybe not. But I'm asking myself, what's the right, fair, constructive way to enact big visionary reforms that are going to get us out of these problems and not exacerbate the problems? I think that's an invigorating question to be asked.
You have been involved in some municipal pension talks. I mean, you've always been around with sort of alternative proposals. I mean, you've talked about retirement programs, things like that. Where are we? Because, you know, since the pension reform was considered unconstitutional, there really hasn't, you know, you've seen with Senate President Cullerton's idea and Bruce Rauner, Governor Rauner's weird kind of we agree but we disagree kind of dance they did. Where are we? I mean, are you guys actively trying to come up with reform, or are you just sort of like, well, the court said no, so I guess we'll just see what happens?
Well, a few things. First of all, the courts didn't just say no to that one bill. The courts issued a really broad
– you can't change it.
Yeah, a very – they chose to go big in their opinion. And it's – I think we've got to take it very seriously. And there are people who like to kind of pretend it's not really what it looks like. No, it's what it looks like, and we have to take it seriously.
What do you mean? You mean just the idea that
– there are people who say, oh, well, yeah, that specific bill wasn't quite right, but if you tweak it a little bit, you'll be all right. No, no, no. They went out of their way to say, look – this is a contractual right. You can't make changes, neither prospectively nor retroactively, and you can't use kind of the excuse of, hey, the state's in a really, really awful situation to get out of the contract. You have to make good on it. So I think, first of all, we've got to take that seriously. Now, President Cullerton has always felt that they would say that, and he's had a different legal theory, the theory of offer and consideration and acceptance that he thinks should guide us in designing reforms. And it looks like he and the governor have an agreement now on a solution. Now, not all of us are confident that that solution would be upheld either, but it's a different legal theory and one that he's eager to test. I think that there's a lot of different types of approaches that one could take. I think one could do completely voluntary changes, right? Give people a menu of options. Mm-hmm. One of the options is keep exactly what you have. And so that's clearly constitutional since you're allowing people to do so. But give them a menu of options which might give people the desire to entirely voluntarily change. I think there's some administrative changes one could make as well. I think there's a menu of things that can be done. What I really appreciate about President Cullerton's approach to this is he's trying to thread the needle and be thoughtful and careful. He's not interested in going as big as possible for the sake of beating up the workers or for the sake of getting the best headline. He's actually trying to get the ball across the finish line and move forward. And I think with a problem like this, which is so ethically complex, so technically complex, and so legally constrained, you're only ever going to make progress if you actually are thoughtful and measured and careful and conciliatory.
Because otherwise, in 8 months, you're going to be right where you started.
Exactly. And it's just a waste of time.
Let me ask you about, we hear a lot of the code words, I mean, making Illinois more competitive, restructuring government, all leading towards this idea that has been floated a lot in the press and seems to be supported by Governor Rauner of municipal bankruptcy. You're a math guy.
Yeah.
What's your take on this? I mean, because I've seen the Better Government Association lean in, or I've seen the Tribune talk about it. I mean, there seems to be some sort of like, well, maybe this is a good idea.
All right, I gotta unbutton my button.
Here
and
comes
loosen my tie for this one. Municipal bankruptcy is usually a really bad idea. It is a place of very last resort. It is totally unnecessary right now, and it is dangerous, irresponsible, and reckless to be throwing that concept around. For example, you'll notice that the Chicago Board of Education pulled their bond issuance less than a week after the concept of CPS bankruptcy got thrown around. The problem with bankruptcy, beyond the obvious of you're harming workers and you're harming, you know, bondholders and you're harming the ability of the government to provide services now, beyond that is that you create an incredible long-term hit on the reputation of the government. And so if I am a teacher who would love to go teach in Chicago public schools because I think the mission of educating kids in the city of Chicago is extraordinarily important, but I've got options to go elsewhere instead, am I going to ever pick CPS if there's an entity that goes bankrupt sometimes and might just wipe out my pension and fire me for no reason, regardless of how my performance? If I'm a family who is choosing to live in the city of Chicago because of the many extraordinary benefits that the city of Chicago has and is sending my children to the Chicago public schools, which, by the way, is a thing that increasing number of families who have choices are doing, which is really, really good for the city.
Present. Right.
Glad to know it.
Yeah.
Would a family that is choosing to do that now but has lots of other options continue to choose to do it if the school district goes bankrupt periodically, leaving you to assume that there's complete instability in your kids' education? No, families aren't going to make that choice. And so what you're doing by going bankrupt is, in addition to all the short-term harm you're causing, you are wiping out the district's ability to attract workers and families for literally a generation. It is really dangerous. It's really harmful. And every time someone opens their mouth and suggests it, that's a step in the wrong direction.
All right. Let me ask you, as we wrap up here, let me ask you about the MAP funding stuff. This week, you guys essentially are going against the idea that there's no budget and saying we got to fund higher education, community colleges, some four-year universities. We have to get financial aid to the students who need it because they're being shut out. Talk about this, because you guys were able to get something through, but there's a good chance that the governor's going to say no.
He may well veto it, which would be a real shame. Here's why we did this. And you're right. This is not a complete budget. This is just another piece.
It's a stopgap. Yeah.
Another stopgap piece of the spending. And it's not part of a sustainable budget solution, which is a shame. But here's the thing. Here's what the MAP grant is, the Monetary Award Program. It is a need-based tuition assistance for Illinois resident students who go to college in Illinois. So if you qualify, let's say, for $3,500 of MAP assistance, the state or the Illinois Student Assistance Commission will send $3,500 to your college, and they'll therefore lower your tuition by $3,500. Those letters promising that award to those students went out early last spring, February, right, March. And then the money wasn't put in the budget. The students were told they were going to get it. The universities were told they were going to get it. And then when the fall came, there was no money in the budget, and the universities told the students last fall, hey, don't worry, we're not going to ask you to make up that difference. We're just going to kind of, at least for now, eat it. Well, now that we're hitting the spring and the universities have eaten a big loss and are, by the way, in the case of public universities and community colleges, not getting any other state aid, they're starting to say, well, we're not sure how long we can do this.
Right.
We can maybe continue to not charge you right now, but if the state doesn't eventually make us whole, we'll
have to put it
on your tuition.
Right.
And as a result of that uncertainty, 1,000 kids, poor kids who otherwise would be in school today, are going home.
And not returning.
Exactly. Right. I mean, and having to make other arrangements, having to all of a sudden find a mechanism of providing for themselves without the benefit of the kind of education they were expecting to have. It's crazy. It is wrong. It is unfair. It is unjust. And so while I think we obviously need to pass a single comprehensive balanced budget, and doing this one bit at a time is a frustrating way of doing it, the choice before us, which is now the choice before the governor, as he can sign or veto this bill, is to say, hey, those 1,000 kids should go to school, or those 1,000 kids should stay home. I voted yes because I want those kids to go to school, and the governor should sign the bill to allow those kids to go to school.
You know what I like about this is that sounds like the politics I know. That sounds like the lawmaking I know. You put something together, the governor says, I like it or I don't like it, sends it back. If you think that it's such a big deal that you get two-thirds, like that's the government we learned about in civics class. That's what we want to see, I think, as the taxpayers of Illinois. More of this, less of this political chicken.
Yeah, listen, I mean, nobody wants us to sit in Springfield and stare at each other about how we're not doing stuff. It's time for us to actually sit down, negotiate, not just on this university issue, though goodness knows that's important, but on the whole suite of budget issues and get moving again.
Senator Daniel Biss, he represents northern suburbs like Skokie and Glenview. He's a Democrat. Thanks for coming in. Good to see you. And, you know, we'll have to check in as the session continues in Springfield.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be back.
Hit me with that frying pan. Hit me with that frying pan. Hit me with that frying pan.
There it is. Yes, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. You hear that sound? That is the frying pan. We are ready for the best radio
best hour in Chicago radio. It's time to put Shark Tank Steve Gadlin into the frying pan. Yeah, there you go. Gadlin, of course, is the brain behind the successful local business. I want to draw a cat for you.com. He presented his business idea on the television program Shark Tank, and he snagged Mark Cuban as a principal investor. Now Steve has to go back to Cuban with new ideas. And before he goes into that pressure cooker, he comes to WGN Radio to jump into the frying pan. There we go. He's giving us this exclusive business idea so we can poke holes in it and give Steve the confidence to pitch it to Mark Cuban himself. Steve Gadlin, welcome back, buddy. Good to see you.
It's great to see you, Justin.
It's been a couple weeks. You know, we haven't had shows because of the Blackhawks and other things and the holidays, and we haven't been able to see you. So it's great. And that, I would assume that gives you a little bit of time to marinate your ideas.
Yeah, you know, I call it percolation. The ideas come fast and furious all the time. But what this time off has done is really given me time to refine an idea that I know your audience is
going
to love.
All right, there we go. So you know what? Let's get to it. The number, let me throw the number out. This is for numbers you can... You can call in or you can text in whether or not you like Steve Gadlin's new idea, 312-981-7200, the way we play yay or nay on the new idea. So, Steve, without further ado, why don't we get to this week's frying pan idea?
Okay, so this one solves a problem that we all have. We go out to restaurants now, and we either put our name in at the front or we place our order. And instead of being shown to a table or being given our food, we're given a square little pager or a rectangular pager.
Right, if you go to the Outback Steakhouse or something like that.
Right, pretty much any restaurant in the city. So if you have one of those, you then have to wait until that pager blinks and glows and buzzes until you're allowed to go to your seat and sit and enjoy your dinner or before you can go to the counter and pick up your meal. And what always frustrated me about that is suddenly you're eating on someone else's terms. Who is this person that gets to decide when it's your turn to get your food or when it's your turn to eat? So the invention that we're testing right now, and it's working quite well, it's called the Me First.
The Me First.
Yes. Now, the Me First is actually a keychain apparatus that hooks right onto your keys. And it works because all of these devices are really just engineered through simple radio signals. So what you do is when you're handed your buzzer or you're handed your little pager, you take the Me First, you hold it over, you wait till the red light turns green, meaning we've picked up the signal, you press the button and your device will immediately buzz. It will immediately start blinking and buzzing.
So it almost hijacks the
I wouldn't say hijack. It tells the restaurant that it's your turn. Me First. So you take that up to the counter and they'll give you your food or they'll show you to your table, which will be ready. The Me First.
All right, I have questions.
Sure.
But I'm not going to I'm going to let the listeners ask the questions and evaluate the Me First.
You know, it's really about taking control of mealtime back into the hands of the consumer instead of into the hands of the maitre d' or the host or hostess.
Okay. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And see if you have an idea, one way or the other, on the Me First, which again is a device that sort of co-opts the radio frequency of one of the restaurant's pagers to manipulate to make you first in line.
You keep saying co-opt and manipulate. Really what it does is it tells the restaurant it's your turn. It's eating on your terms because you're the one who's coming to the restaurant to spend money. So it tells the restaurant that your table is ready. It tells the restaurant that your food is ready when you are ready to eat.
All right, the lines are lighting up. Pete's on the line. He's staging the calls, getting them ready. 312-981-7200. You know, why don't we take a break so we can get these, so we can get everybody lined up. And when we come back, we'll get to yay or nay on the Me First here in the frying pan. Download. Stay with us.
Hit me with that frying pan. 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 I said, hit me.
All right. It's the frying pan. I love it. I love that sound. Steve Gadlin from IWantToDrawACatForYou.com is in studio with his newest invention, an invention that he wants us to poke holes into and see if it's right and ready to pitch to his principal investor, Mark Cuban. Steve, one more time on the Me First.
Yeah, so the Me First is a device that takes eating timing of your eating back into your own hands when you're at a restaurant. Basically, when you order your food or put your name in for a table and you're given one of those familiar pagers and sent back to wait for who knows, for however long the restaurant decides, basically. This is a device that's on your keychain that taps into those radio signals. Mm-hmm. You hold it over your pager, press the button, and yours will immediately start glowing and buzzing. So you can take that back to the host or hostess, get your food, or get seated right away.
Okay, 312-981-7200. The lines are jacked. We also have a ton of texts. Let's go right to it. Dan, yay or nay on the me first?
Well, I'm going to say nay for a couple reasons. Reason number one would be, let's say you go ahead and you do this, but all of the tables are still full. So obviously you could take that up and they're going to say, well, you got to wait till the next person gets up and leaves.
Yeah.
Second of all,
go ahead.
If it does go off of, you know, frequencies and radio signals, do you have it set to where you wouldn't activate 20 of them? You know, everyone
great
who's
question.
Waiting.
Yeah. Great technology question. Thanks, Dan. Let's hear what Steve has to say, because you had to have thought about the idea of what if a table's not ready.
Well, that's not how restaurants work, to be honest. There are always tables ready. They're always bringing someone to their table. Restaurants are designed with cyclical strategy in mind, so that people are always being let in and someone's always being let out. Mm-hmm. So there's always a table ready. The restaurant, up till now, has been the one to decide who gets to have it.
Most of you think it's like a privilege kind of thing. They're choosing people based on clout or something else.
We don't know how they're choosing people. This takes that out of the equation, and it puts the power back into your hands, literally.
312-981-7200. What about Dan's other question about technology? I mean, are you worried that it would set off more than just the one that you used?
No. So this is also Bluetooth connected to your phone. So what that does is it provides a way for us to make sure we're linking to the pager that's in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you hold it right up to the pager and wait for that red light to turn green. Then it's speaking directly to the pager that you're holding.
312-981-7200. 606 text in. They say, you know what? I would never go to a restaurant where I have to be seated, wait to be seated, period. So that's a yay, because that's what you're saying. I'm not going
to
wait.
Well, you don't have to anymore.
You don't have to.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's 847's got a great question. What if everyone in the restaurant has the me first? This is from Sue in Glenview, who's a fan.
Well, thanks, Sue. You know, that's a good question. It's our hope that everyone will have one of these, to be honest, because we want to put the control back into the people's hands instead of into the host or hostess, who may be seating people based on criteria we don't even know. We have no idea how they get that order, but this allows us to make a line. If everyone has one and everyone presses that button, well, you know, they will press them in a certain order, and they will get to the booth in a certain order, so they'd probably just form a line. And on a first-come, first-served basis, get to have their food or get the table. So,
okay.
You know, but at least it puts some predictable order to the process.
312-981-7200. Let's go to Kathy. Kathy, you're on the frying pan. Yay or nay to me first?
Nay.
Oh. Why?
Well, first of all, your comment about the predictable order, there's already a predictable order. That's the order you came in and you signed in. I also think that it's rude, because the people that don't have one are going to sit there and wait and wonder why people that came in after them get to be seated before they will. And pretty much I'm thinking that's going to be our older generation who isn't so techno savvy and isn't going to have your device.
Thank you, Kathy. So it's ageist.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think it's actually a great marketing tool. If you see someone using it and getting to go ahead of you, well, then you might go out and buy one. And that helps. Again, this is more a pitch to my potential investors than it is to potential customers. But I'll tell you, there's no greater motivator for buying something than, no, wait, I want to go first. You know, again, that's why
it's kind of the iPhone mentality.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
People stand in line for that, so they're the first ones that have it.
Yeah, and she says it's a predictable order already. No, that's what I'm saying. We're trained to believe it is, but we don't know that it is. Hmm. And this takes the mystery out of the equation, puts it right into your hands, right onto your keychain.
Well, every time we one caller hangs up, another one takes the place. Let's go to Earl. Earl, frying pan, yay or nay to the me first?
Nay. Kaufman, I can't believe this isn't one of your comedian buddies, because this is outrageous. It's basically cheating and getting ahead of other people. How do you feel when you're in line at a takeout right. place and somebody tries to butt into line ahead of you? And also, I was a host in a restaurant for 8 years.
Oh.
And the reason you don't get a table is because there are no tables.
So you're saying that it's a legitimate system where Steve is questioning the authenticity of the host and the way that they choose tables.
Yes, I do.
All right. Earl, thank you for that.
I don't think it's cheating. I really don't. I think it is, again, taking your own fate into your own hands, and everyone has an equal opportunity to do that for only $79.95.
Oh, I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the monthly subscription to the Me First. So if you are paying your monthly subscription, then you have the same capability as everyone else in the building. And in terms, again, you know, 50 hosts can call us and say that this is a perfectly standard first-come, first-serve system. We've all seen movies where the famous movie star walks in,
right.
snaps their fingers, and, oh, magically right. there's a table for them.
Right, they're always
the
able
tables
to get
are
one.
There. The tables are there. There. You know, let's take the tables back.
312-981-7200. Let's go to Sean. Sean, yay or nay on the frying pan idea this week, the Me First.
Yeah, Steve, I'm sorry. I think you're just trying to market a product here.
Yeah.
I think there are enough people that feel entitled that might want to buy this
great.
So that they can go first.
That's great.
But part of the system that already exists and allows you to take control is your ability to call ahead and say, I want a reservation.
That's a great question. Sean, I had the same thought. Yep.
And that's my ability to take control. Or if you don't do that, then you get your little fanny down to the restaurant early enough so you feel like you're there when you want to eat, be it 30 minutes later or whatnot.
Thank you, Sean. That's interesting. I thought the same thing about reservations. It seems like someone had this invention before, and it was called the reservation system.
Okay, fine. So, if you know, maybe we just call this the instant reservation system, and maybe people won't think it's such a cheat or a rude thing.
So maybe the name, maybe it's the Me First is making people think it's selfish and cheating. Maybe if you change it to, like, instant reservation.
Maybe it puts that in a framework that people already understand, because, Sean, that's all this is. It's making a reservation so that you can eat when you feel like eating.
Mm-hmm.
It's just instead of calling ahead, you're making the reservation instantly.
Let's go to John. John, yay or nay on the Me First? What do you think, bud?
Kind of no.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. The FCC would probably like to knock on the door on that one, even though it's a low-power transmitter and this, that, and everything else. What frequency you're going to run at, this, that, things like that.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've been in restaurants before, and they say, well, we don't really have those little octagon-sided gizmos or
yeah.
square-sided gizmos. But we'll take your phone number and send you a text.
Oh, yeah, that's
when
the new style.
Ready.
Yeah, that's a new style, right.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, I've been going to one of your major sponsors. I'm going to ding, 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 ding. Mark Malnati.
Right.
Malnati's pizza.
Yeah, the Malnati's, right.
And I'll pre-order a pizza, and I'll say, I'm going to be there in 40 minutes. Just have a table ready, and
They say,
cool, everything's good, and, you know, because they have always plenty
yeah,
of
Yeah, right. All right, thanks, John.
Never
had a problem. Thanks, John. I appreciate that.
You know, John, we have to remember this is not just about tables. You know, maybe people are so hung up on tables. Remember, you go to a restaurant like Panera, you place your order, and then you have to wait until your buzzer buzzes to go pick up your food from the counter.
Right.
So how nice would it be to place your order and then use the Me First and be able to go up to the counter and get your food right away without having to wait for them to tell you your food is ready?
Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, how cool would it be to go to Lou Malnati's and say, hi, I just, on a whim, decided to come in here. I'd like a deep dish sausage pizza. And then you press the button and voila, here's your pizza, sir.
312-981-7200 is the number. Let's take one more call before the break. Let's go to Mark. Mark, yay or nay on the Me First.
Big fan of the show, and Steve, big fan of your first venture through Shark Tank. I like it, but I think you could actually do better,
okay.
to be honest. I think on the way to the restaurant, a lot of restaurants don't take reservations now, especially quick serve. And this is sort of the style of restaurant you're referring to. This is not the style of restaurant where you've had to reserve 3 months ahead of time.
Right.
You're talking about fast casual restaurants right now.
Right.
So at a fast casual restaurant, say I'm going to one that takes no reservations. Well, through my smartphone, why can't I just inform the restaurant that I'm on the way? And that through location-based services, the restaurant knows how serious I am about actually coming.
Thanks, Mark. That's a great point. That's, again, a technology. It's a technology tweak. What do you think of that?
Well, I'll be honest. It's something that I've already thought of and that we are implementing. Putting all this functionality right into your smartphone instead of having you clip on the extra device. Since this is a subscription model, $79.95 a month, you know, we don't care if you've got the device clipped on or if you're using the app. So it's a good idea. It's one I've thought of. But we, you know, I'll let you know, though, we're not into – it's not fair that the restaurant gets to know ahead of time we're coming. Again, that's giving them more information than they really need.
You're
to
really
know.
About taking the sort of this is really a libertarian approach to restaurant waiting, where you're saying, you know what, we're evening the score, we're turning the tables, we're taking the power back.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So, you know, I'll be honest, if you're on your way somewhere, who's to say you don't change your mind and see a cool restaurant on the way and stop there? Mm. You know, the whole idea of pre-planning these days, I think, goes out the window. Nobody's doing that anymore.
Well, I do say that was it. Mark gave us a yay on that one, so we're going to put that in the yay category. 312-981-7200. We're doing frying pan tonight. The idea of the me first, a contraption that I don't want to use negative language, but tricks the pager into putting you first in front of everybody else. That's pretty much how you sum it up. 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We'll get to the news with Rob, and we'll come back, and we'll take your text and get to some of the more personal stuff that is coming through here. 312-981-7200. It's a download.
Hit me with that frying pan. 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 I said, hit me.
So good. Pete Zimmerman, Beats by Zim on that one. Hit me with that frying pan. That's right. We are back in studio with Steve Gadlin, the local inventor and innovator behind IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He won on Shark Tank. The principal investor is Mark Cuban. He's supposed to bring new ideas to Mark. Before he does that, he brings them here to the WGN audience for a yay or nay tonight. The idea is called the Me First. Mm-hmm. One more time, the elevator pitch, Mr. Gadlin.
Yeah, so the Me First is a little device that hooks onto your keychain, and when you go to a restaurant and they tell you, I'm sorry, your food's not ready, here's this pager for you, or I'm sorry, we can't seat you
so
yet.
So frustrating.
All this, it's very frustrating because they control when you eat and when you get to sit down and order. The Me First, you hold it up next to one of those pagers, press the button, and it will make it start buzzing and blinking so you can get your food right away, so you can get seated right away. It tells the restaurant, no, me first.
312-981-7200. It's a shortcut, right? I mean, that might be a more positive word than sort of a trick or...
Well, you know what? You wouldn't call it a shortcut if someone put a bunch of gates leading up to your front door. Mm-hmm. And you found a way to hop over those gates. That's not a shortcut. That's removing an obstacle that doesn't even need to be there.
You're sort of like a restaurant or a diner's advocate in a way. You're like an activist for changing the way, sort of freeing us from...
Oh, I advocate for all consumers. And once you get on the $79.95 a month subscription plan, you've got us in your corner.
All right, let's go to the lines. Let's go to Nabel. Nabel, yay or nay on the frying pan idea this week, the me first.
Yes, first-time caller, really excited. But, yeah, this idea I think would be great if you had restaurants that would implement it. Uh-huh. I think a lot of restaurants that do have tables available but don't have servers available. So the level of service would drastically, you know, go down if you are constantly. Yeah, so a lot of tables are available only for the fact that there are not a server for those tables.
Right. Thank you so much, Abel. Thank you for that. That's a good point. Do you run the risk of having this immediacy and then seeing a sort of reduction in the quality of the service and possibly the food?
Look, I'm no restaurant expert. I'll say that now. Mm-hmm. I rarely eat out. But when I do, I often see servers just sort of chit-chatting around the register. So what this does is it motivates them to appreciate their job more. and it gives everyone a better experience. So, again, I'll be honest. I probably dine out once every 4 or 5 months, always on my birthday, always on my mother's birthday, and then if I'm invited out with friends. So, you know, I've relied on a lot of research from my peers to help bring this product to fruition.
Right. Yes. 630 gives a yay, says, I'm a selfish SOB.
Great.
And I love
it. Well, I don't know what the two things are, how those are related.
Well, me for like there's a lot, and we're going to get to that in the text about etiquette, selfishness, and the idea of a me first society. There's a lot of sort of, you know, indicting this or sort of looking at how we are as a people.
Well, look, the train has already left the station as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. We are how we are as a society. And again, I'm speaking to investors primarily. Here is a tool that supports that people are going to buy.
Well, you get some 630 says, whatever happened to waiting your turn, something you should have learned in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. 563 says, so the heck with all the other people who've been waiting longer than you, that's just wrong. You know, it just says there's a sentiment here as I keep going. Let's see. I'm going to save that one. That's a good one. There's a lot of other ideas here, but it's just a lot of people say it's just rude.
Well, level playing field. Every person has the opportunity to pay $79.95 a month for the subscription plan and another $79.95 for the actual hardware. So this is a level playing field. Everyone has the opportunity to own the Me First.
Know, so,
and we have a premium subscription for $149.95 a month. You get the No Me First with me in bold on that one, where you can go before someone who used the Me First.
Oh, wow. So it's a different frequency.
Yes. Well, no, same frequency, but
it blocks their frequency.
It's a card that you hold up that says, no, well, Me First.
219's got a great point. They said Six Flags does this. It's called the Fast Pass. I mean, the idea that you jump in front for you know, but for an extra fee.
Right. Well, that fee in that case goes to Six Flags. This fee is not going to the restaurant. This fee is going to my company, which provides the service, and we are not in partnership with the restaurant. We are restaurant agnostic. We do not hop into bed with any of these food providers. We are there for you. You believe
that it's your right to get the food as quick as you can because you came in to eat there.
Not necessarily as quick as you can. We understand that it sometimes takes some time to make the food. We want you to get it when you're ready, not when the restaurant tells you you're ready. How condescending is that?
Well, let's go to
babies in high chairs.
Well, let's go to Craig. Craig's got a point on that. Craig, welcome to the download. All right, the Me First, yay or nay?
At first, I thought it was a joke, but your screener assures me that it's not. But if you want to spend $1,000 a year to be an egomaniac, I guess that's up to you. But the part,
what does that have to do with the product? Are you talking about spending $1,000 a year to get headshots every month? No, this is
it's $1,000 a year to have this service. Costs it's $80 a month plus the cost of the
unit. We haven't
done
full calculations on it, but it is $79.95 a month.
Yeah, that's $959 and some change a year. It's what it costs.
Well, you're forgetting some startup costs.
Oh, okay.
You're forgetting hardware costs.
Yeah, and that's $79.95 also. So it's over $1,000.
Well, there are some hidden costs as well.
It's over $1,000 a year. So yeah, you're justifying charging people over $1,000 to exercise their ego. Maybe.
I don't get where the $1,000 comes from because this is $79.95 a month.
In the course of a year, you will spend $1,000.
But how much do you spend at restaurants over the course of a year? To be decided, right?
That's true.
I think you're throwing fuzzy math at me to confuse the potential consumers.
But the second part is the part that really kills me. And you just acknowledged it, actually, that you can go up there and say, where's my food? Not the part about getting a table, but the part about getting your food when you're ready.
Yes.
And you go up there, and the food isn't ready because they haven't made it yet.
Right.
And you're standing there saying, hey, where's my food? Where's my food?
Right.
You're an idiot.
I agree.
Now, I don't see that. I don't see that scenario. Well,
that's what I say. You're an idiot.
Well, now hold on a second here.
Yeah, your food is ready when the light is blinking, except that you're making the light blink before your food is ready because that's what you want to do. But your food's not ready.
I think you're buying into a lot of restaurant propaganda here, sir. Because
I have to give up on Aristotle and the course of logic.
But who gets to tell you when your food is ready?
I would say the kitchen gets to tell me when my food is ready, when they put it out so that I can go and pick it up.
Well, that's where you and I disagree, sir.
All right, so there we go.
Okay, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Greg. Appreciate it. There you go, 312-981-7200. That was a tough, I mean, Craig made some really good points there.
I did not hear one good point, and maybe I'm confused.
All right.
Maybe I'm confused because I don't dine at restaurants frequently.
All right. Well, 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll read the texts. We'll get to some of the more personal stuff, get to the phone calls and wrap it up before 11. The Me First here on the Frying Pan. Stay with us.
Hit me with that frying pan.
All right, it's the Frying Pan. Steve Gadlin in studio with me tonight. 312-981-7200. We got 10 minutes to get through a lot of texts, and thank you for the yay. And what I love about this, Download Nation really comes to play in the way of giving Steve constructive criticism. Mm. And a little bit personal, and we saved the last part for the personal. 312-981-7200. All right, let's see what we got here. 815 says, so you'd spend $80 a month for a restaurant app that you might not even use. You're an idiot.
Well, I wouldn't, but the hope is the customer will.
563 says, $80 a month, somebody hit him in the head with the frying pan.
Okay.
708 just says, this guy's an idiot. So these are not necessarily constructive, but there's a lot on that theme.
You know, the $80 a month price point, how much do you pay for cable every month? How much do you pay for Netflix and Hulu and all those services? It's not out of line. How much do you pay to go to the gym every month?
Yeah.
$80 a month is just another thing on top of all that.
847 says this guy is clearly removed from common sense. Mm-hmm. 630, and he also can't do math.
Okay.
So they're really getting on you about that.
Mm-hmm.
773 says, does it come with a stun gun attachment in case someone doesn't want me to go first? There's a lot about there. There's a lot saying, what about the people who be upset that you get to skip in front of them?
Yeah, we got in trouble as a company with using stun technology on a few of our inventions, mm-hmm. so we stay away from that. Otherwise, it's a good idea.
773 says, what about shock collars for servers?
Yeah, again, that's one we actually pitched on the show, I think. Resounding.
Yeah, that was a 2015.
Yeah.
They didn't like that. Mm-hmm. Let's go to some of these calls. Let's just try let's go to AJ. AJ, welcome to the frying pan. Yay or nay on Me First?
Yay.
Okay.
First time caller. You know, I appreciate everything you do. I mean, it's hard to just be in a venter, so I mean, kudos to you on that one. But I really don't appreciate that, you know, for $80, man, you gotta look at the expensive, you know, because I mean, for $20, I know this particular restaurant I could go to for $20, always busy. I give $20 to a hostess and she'll let me in right away.
Right. Oh, that's a good thing point.
I'm a cook, so it's going to be hard for me. That means those tickets are going to come before the other ones, and I have to focus on those tickets before I serve my customer. All I want to do is give them the best quality food.
Well, you're helping to prove my point, AJ. You tip a hostess $20, you eat there once a week, that's your $80 right there.
Yeah,
who says
right.
I can't
so
do
this
math?
Is kind of like, that's a great point. That's the economics actually are in your favorite. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Angelique. Angelique, welcome to the Frying Pan Me First Year Name.
Well, thank you. And Nay Child, all I have to say is this is replete with liability issues. If I have been sitting there waiting for 45 minutes and have been growing increasingly hangry, there are going to be, at the very least, nasty looks, glowers, and hisses at anybody who gets in front of me in order to get to my food.
Right, that was the question about the stun gun. That's right. Angelique, thank you for that.
Well, sounds like Angelique just needs to also purchase a Me First.
Yeah, if she had one, then
solved.
Yeah, exactly. Bob, let's go to Bob. Bob, Me First, yay or nay?
Nay on the Me First.
You're a server.
Yes, I'm a server at a busy Chicago restaurant, and we do happen to get a lot of regulars, so here's where my problem comes in. Now, on slow days, those regulars are what makes my paycheck. and somebody comes in, me first, they're used to me coming over, taking care of them right away. I may not be able to give them that service. They might stop coming.
Right.
Sometimes somebody has one bad experience.
And that's
there
it.
They go out yeah. the door. I say, also the scenario, I sometimes have a party of 30 come in.
Ooh.
I get a couple of tables with this me first. I have to take care of them. Now, you know, maybe $500 in sales versus their $50 or $60 checks right there. That's going to impact my day.
Yeah, right. Thanks, well, Bob. Thanks for that.
You know, I don't think that's a problem with what I'm selling. You know, if you miss out on a party of 30 because someone came in with the me first, I think everyone just needs to learn, you know, first come, first serve. That's first come, first serve is the type of philosophy we all really need to embrace. And that's
mm-hmm. seen it know, play out. Yeah. yeah. Sonny, yay or nay on me first.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Oh, praise God. Doing great. Just driving around, staring out a window. I drive a truck for a living. I don't want somebody who doesn't drive a truck to tell me how to drive my truck.
Mm-hmm.
This guy doesn't go out to eat, but he's telling us how to go out and eat. I eat out 5 days a week. Every night I shut down and I get a hotel and I go out to different restaurants in different areas. And that's all part of the dining experience. And if you're rushing in and rushing out to eat, you might as well go to Burger King.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, thank you, Sonny. Thank you for that.
Sonny, I'm an inventor, and I don't like non-inventors telling me how to invent my products. Okay. So, touche.
Touche. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go through some of these. 773 says nay, nay, nay.
Okay.
847 says your guest is a prime example of what's wrong with our society.
Interesting.
708 says nay. What makes you think your food will be ready just because you say it is? Capital U.
Well, what makes you think your food is ready just because the restaurant says it is?
630 says you'll be the first to get slugged when taking someone else's food.
Well, nothing about this is taking anyone else's food.
847 says there are way too many holes in your premise to sell this to investors. Mm-hmm. Nay. That's actually, that one cuts close. That's probably, I know you pretty well after doing this.
You know, there are a lot of holes in a business designed around selling stick figure cats to people, but I hooked Mark Cuban as an investor, and they're selling
quite
well.
Here we go. Okay, let's get defensive. We've talked about this. Okay. 630 says, this guy has no clue.
Okay, interesting.
630 says, I say yes because it's all about me, which seems sarcastic.
Great. Well, but he's right.
630 just says botulism. So I think that's about this conversation. Could be a different radio station. I'm not sure
mm-hmm.
if that has. 773 says, nay, this is for whiny brats. Grow up, selfish, barf.
Well,
those are all like period, selfish, period, barf. So that's just so you get an idea.
Yeah, I think the problem is you have a lot of consumers that listen to your station, mm-hmm. but you don't have a lot of seasoned investors that listen to your station.
Well,
sometimes, you know, I don't know what your demo is, but sometimes it takes a wise investor in their 20s or 30s to really understand a product versus, you know, maybe when you get into older age in your 40s and up, you're just not hip to modern concepts and might not see see the benefit of something.
563 says, what makes you better than everybody else? 847 says, take your entitlement software elsewhere.
Okay.
847 says, you are not realistic. 262 said, this would be a better idea to use in a public restroom, which I do agree. That if you had a me first and you were able to kick somebody out of a toilet when you needed it, that's an interesting...
No, that's good. We actually have something like that in development already.
And finally, 414 says...
It's called P first.
Oh, that's great.
No, I'm just making a joke.
You're just making that up. You're making that up. Yeah. All right, 414, and this will leave on this one, says a better name for the me first is the a-hole, which is you. So.
Okay.
I just think
I'm taking the criticism, and I'm going to process it and come back stronger and better for it, but I think there were some yays in there that got swallowed.
It's hard to say because a lot of it
You only hear
seemed,
the squeaky wheels.
It seemed a little the yays seemed very sarcastic. They were like, yay, because I'm a jerk. This is perfect for me because I'm a jerk. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if they were yays. Mm-hmm. I think they were sarcastic yays. People are kind of mocking you.
I didn't sense any mocking in any of the comments.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, again, I might be oblivious to what's going on here.
Well, I think that I love the concept, and I do say that I love the idea that you're putting the consumer first. I think that that's something new as opposed to the business, and I like the idea that this is for investors.
Yeah.
I just think that the Download Nation spoke, and they unequivocally said, Nay.
Well, next week then, huh?
I guess so. Okay. Steve Gadlin will be back next week here on The Download for The Frying Pan every Friday night at 10 o'clock. Steve, keep your head up. I know next week you're going to have a winner.
Yep.
Well, that was a good one. Good frying pan. It was a good idea. You know, I think I like the concept. I like the idea of consumers first, you know, and there may be some corruption in that. We don't know. You know, the corruption of like Steve had said about celebrities getting a table before you or regulars getting a table before you and you not being able to compete with that. So I like the idea of the level playing field, but it seemed like the technology and the concept weren't fully baked. So we'll try again next week here in the frying pan. Rob, I saw you were shaking your head a lot, so I know that you
I loved it. It was actually one of his first ideas that I
really
wholeheartedly endorse. Absolutely.
You like that.
Little key fob. It's subtle. You get your pager. That green light goes on. Boop. I'm ready to be seated.
Well, he left pretty dejected. I'm not going to lie to you. So I hope he's hearing this part because there was not a lot of encouragement. So
there's some pretty tough people out there.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's why, you know, I actually like it. He needs a toughness. He needs tough love. Otherwise, he'll go to Mark Cuban, and Mark Cuban will ask all those questions, and he won't be ready for him. So this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Well, that's going to do it for us here on The Download. Patty Vasquez with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez coming up next.